Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Let me also take a moment here to offer my prayers and my condolences to the family of Matthew Shepard, as well as to the community of Laramie, Wyoming, and the university. While it wouldn't be proper for me to comment on the specifics of this case, I do want to say again, crimes of hate and crimes of violence cannot be tolerated in our country. In our shock and grief, one thing must remain clear: hate and prejudice are not American values. The most critical one, perhaps, is education. 8 months ago in my State of the Union address, I asked the Congress to help local communities. I hope that in the grief of this moment for Matthew Shepard's family and in the shared outrage across America, Americans will once again search their hearts and do what they can to reduce their own fear and anxiety and anger at people who are different. And I hope that Congress will pass the hate crimes legislation. Thank you.
The Cows, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of racism. Today's date, Sunday, July 3rd, 2016. So I have been told, just to save me a little bit of stress and anguish, our guest, if you could press star 6, Mr. Jimenez, if you could press star 6, I think you'll hear the prompt to press 1. That way I'll know which line is yours, and we can proceed. That way I don't have to go through and try and dig out all the lines to pick out our author for the program. Our broadcast for today, I think with all of the commentary about what happened in Florida, has not quite been a month yet, about 3 weeks ago, if memory is correct, the shooting at the Pulse nightclub, gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, took place. It is still ongoing in terms of information, more information coming out about the shooter, what took place, all of those details. I am certain there will be books and publications and probably a lot of thick reports that give us more information on what happened with all of the carnage last month down in Florida. But I know it was widely reported, we discussed it here on this program, widely reported that this was a hate crime and that this shooting took place specifically at a gay nightclub on Latin night, at this gay gay nightclub, and happened specifically to target these people because they were gay. And in a lot of the reporting that took place over the past 2-3 weeks, this was emphasized, and they brought in, they mentioned, they invoked the name of Matthew Shepard, and saying that there has been a long wave of violence against people because of their sexual inclination, and that this is a part of the quote-unquote war on gays. As I said, Matthew Shepard, if people are familiar, the federal hate crime bill, it is eponymously named after Matthew Shepard. I think it is officially the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate crime bill that President Obama passed. I think former President Bill Clinton submitted was ultimately signed by President Obama, but that was invoked during the just past couple of weeks talking about what happened down in Orlando, Florida. When I heard Matthew Shepard mentioned, I remembered the book that we're supposed to be talking about today, The Book of Matt. It came out in 2013, and I remember basically the theory of the book. I had not read it at the time. It had been one of those books. I heard about it. I heard an interview that the author did and was like, wow, that is really interesting. I'm going to check that out. I got the book, and as with happens a lot of times, I will get books, and then I won't read them immediately. I'll have them. They'll be on my bookshelf or wherever, and then once I'm motivated, bang, I'll go get it and read it. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Time is right and exact often with when you find out about a book and when you make a decision to read it. But when I was hearing all the reports that this was a hate crime and war on gays type thing, and they mentioned Matthew Shepard, and I said, wow, I remember that book, The Book of Matt, where the author, the premise that he was taking was that a lot of this reporting had been inaccurate in saying that this was a hate crime against Matthew Shepard out in Wyoming in 1998, that he was not, in fact, targeted and killed, murdered, because he was gay. And I said, I'm going to see if we can get him on the program to discuss that book. I think that would be pretty important at this point, particularly since his name continues to be invoked, just to get his view on what he investigated. He spent a lot of time putting this book together. It came out in 2013, so well over a decade of research that went into all this to kind of get his view and see what he thinks and even get his response to some of the critiques that have been put out there to his book. Again, our guest, Mr. Jimenez, if you're with us, if you could press star 6 so I'll know which line you are on. If you're on your phone, just press star 6. You'll hear the prompt to press the number 1, and then I can get you on the line so we can proceed. That way I don't have to go through and dig through all of the numbers to figure out which one is you. He's supposed to be calling in, unless I am mistaken. Double check here, see if he, let's see. Okay, if I don't see him in a second, I'll go ahead and give him a call on his backup if I don't see him in a second here. If I'm one or two, still not seeing. Okay, I'll go ahead and give him a ring. He gave me a backup number to ring him on in case anything went wrong. So just give me a second or two here, and we will ring him on the backup line. Let's see. In fact, I am going to give myself a quick 30 seconds. That way I don't have to have you all in silence as I try to get everything corrected here so I can call him on his backup line. Just hang tight for 1 second. We'll be right back. Give me about 30 seconds. Context of white supremacy.
Hi, Gus.
Oh, greetings, Mr. Jimenez.
Hi. Yes, I was on the phone and I could hear you talking, but you weren't hearing me.
I was not. I guess we if you whichever would be convenient, if you are on the line or if you're still there, if you just tell me what the last 4 digits of your line are, I can pick your line out and I can open you up so that we can hear you on the line. Or if you want to stay on your cell, that'll work too.
Well, you know, my cell doesn't have a great connection. If I dial back and dial the code, will you be able to pick me up? I'm calling from a 215 number.
215. What are your last 4 digits? Because I think we have other 215.
You know, I don't know because I'm here in a friend's house, and I don't know the last 4 digits of his number.
Okay. If you call in within the next 30 seconds or so, I'll just look for the most recent 215.
Okay. And it will be 215, okay?
Outstanding.
Thanks, Gus.
Yes, sir.
I earned it. Access code accepted. This conference is being recorded. Q&A session started.
Is the system white supremacy? That's an instant.
All righty. I called Mr. Jimenez, and I think we got him. I figured out which line he's on, so we should have him with us. Our guest, Mr. Stephen Jimenez. Mr. Jimenez, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I'm here, Gus.
Outstanding. Can hear you crystal clear. Thank you so much for
sharing. Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm sorry for that little snafu there.
We will work it out. No problem at all. for our listeners, I guess this might be a lot of folks their first time hearing about you and the work that you do, anything that you think would be important for folks to know about you?
Well, what I would say is, as a journalist and writer, I'm very interested in the underside of stories that we often don't hear. I think that big media has a tendency to reduce things down to their broad strokes. Sometimes I think of it as the lowest common denominator. So I'm interested in the specifics that sometimes get lost with the headlines, and that's been an interest of mine for a long time, and certainly part of my interest in the Shepherd case.
Right on, right on. I think it's important. You talk about it in the book, and I think it's certainly important for the Matthew Shepherd murder case. You are an openly gay male, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. And for folks also who haven't seen you, what have you, your racial classification, are you a white man?
Well, you know, first of all, I just want to say I'm really honored to be on your show, and the subject, you know, what the things that you often explore are things that are of great interest to me. By background, I'll just say that I'm very much of mixed blood. My paternal grandmother was black from the Dominican Republic. My maternal grandmother was from Puerto Rico. I have some Spanish from Spain as well as French. So I'm quite the you know, racially mixed in terms of my background. I was born in the United States, and so were my parents. But my grandparents, you know, you just go back two generations, and we've got a lot of mixed blood.
Fascinating. For people, you can see a photograph. He has it for a lot of the books, so if you just look online, you'll see Mr. Jimenez. You can see what he looks like visually. Are you, I guess, in terms of your racial classification, so are you able to be accepted as a white person, or do people just see you, or do you...
Well, you know, I've been accepted as white, but as I said, you know, there are people sometimes who will think of me as being Latino or Hispanic. You know, so it's just something that's there in a variety of forms. In fact, when I was looking at your website, I was thinking about, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, where I grew up in a neighborhood that was full of white Irish Catholics, and, you know, coming from a mixed racial background as I did, you know, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of... time to grow up in Brooklyn in the 1960s, but certainly there was a lot of racial epithets were thrown, and it was quite a mixture of things.
I'm sorry. Were you going to say something else?
No. I'm here. I just heard a beep, so I.
Oh, okay. Hope it was not on our end. No technical difficulties today, we hope.
Good.
Just for our listeners' clarification, like, so what's, when you have to fill out a form like the census or your driver's license and they ask for racial classification, like, what box do you check?
Well, okay, so lately I have checked, I've often said, you know, Hispanic, Latino. Sometimes I've said other. You know, when I was younger and didn't know better, I would say Caucasian, but I'm not Caucasian.
Fascinating. Interesting.
You know, I'm on a learning curve with this, as with many other things, Gus.
Fascinating. We are still learning as well. Folks, anybody, if you check, like I said, if you check online, just so you can get a visual representation, if you're more interested to see phenotypically what Mr. Jimenez looks like. Okie-doke. The Book of Matt, again, Matthew Shepherd murdered in 1998 in Wyoming. Why is this book titled The Book of Matt? It certainly, at least to me, has some biblical connotations.
Well, at the time of Matthew's attack, there was a tremendous amount of religious imagery and religious iconography that became associated with this crime. There was a lot of erroneous reporting, too, that depicted him, Matthew Shepherd, as being hanging on a fence. And, you know, immediately there were parallels made to Jesus. I remember seeing certain newspaper illustrations, et cetera. So there was the way in which, you know, being a short guy, he was 21 years old, a somewhat frail stature, blonde hair, that, you know, he was very much portrayed as a Jesus-like figure, and, the horrible murder that happened to him was viewed as a crucifixion. So that was one place where I wanted to address some of the early inaccuracies in the reporting, but also what happened in this case, Gus, is that a mythology very quickly replaced, hard facts and what was true. So I felt that I wanted to, look at what was true and offer an alternate version and really underscore and emphasize the importance of truth, particularly when media descends on a place, as they did Laramie, Wyoming, and a narrative was constructed very quickly that became accepted as fact, and there was a lot of mythologizing there. So, the choosing the Book of Matt was a way of trying to identify some truths in the story that had never come out, and to play those, I guess we could call it, as a counter myth or a different story from the one that had originally been told.
And just for listeners, you were going to write a piece for the New York Times magazine. They scrapped the piece. It was going to be kind of a longer format piece. They scrapped it eventually, I guess, you writing the book because of some of the more controversial aspects of the case that we'll get to. But you ended up not writing that piece. You also worked on a documentary series for ABC's 20 for 20, an hour documentary piece about this case where you got a lot of the information. And then you continued this book ultimately being published in 2013. So you spent, upwards of a dozen years working on this project?
Yes, Gus, I did. I will just say that originally I followed the case in the media in 1998 and 1999. The case ended with the trial of Aaron McKinney, the principal perpetrator. It ended in early November of 1999. When I went to Laramie the first time in early 2000, it was with the idea of writing a script for a made-for-television movie about the story that I believed it to be, which was this was a very important narrative for the gay community at the time, that this was really about someone who had been murdered because he was gay. He had been taken out of a bar, and taken to this remote area outside Laramie and was beaten to death because he was gay. And I originally went to Laramie to gather additional information to write that story. Through meeting the prosecutor in the case and starting to talk with other people and realizing that there was a whole other set of facts, that at that point I went to the New York Times Magazine, set the screenplay aside, and was... they commissioned me to write a story. After I worked on that story for 2 years, they killed it. In the meantime, there had been a change of editors at the Times Magazine, and so the story was killed. No criticism of the journalism or the reporting. They just, they didn't give much, many hard reasons as to why they were killing the story. At the same time, I had started talking to ABC News, and ABC News decided to proceed with the story. So, as you said, it resulted in a one-hour special on 2020 in 2004. My work on the book began quite a bit after that. In terms of what had not made it into the ABC News piece and additional reporting I wanted to do. So I took it to the next step, went back to some of the original sources, and then also got new sources, and so that became the basis of the book.
Wow. You start this book early on with Kevin Robinson. Who is Kevin Robinson, and why so early on do we focus on him in this book?
You know, Gus, I like your interviewing style. You're going right for the heart of the matter. I began it because Kevin Robinson was an African American male who was he was charged with a crime in Laramie 1 year before Matthew Shepard, before the attack on Matthew Shepard. Kevin Robinson was accused and ultimately convicted of murdering a 15-year-old white girl, and she was pregnant at the time. She had only been pregnant for a few weeks, and her body was found in the wilderness in a forest outside Laramie. And Kevin Robinson was identified, he was charged, and ultimately convicted in the killing of this young woman. Her name was Daphne Sulk. And because there were some figures that were important in the Shepherd case, in particularly law enforcement, I was very interested in that case because obviously the Matthew Shepherd case got not only national attention but even international attention. And the, in the case of Daphne Sulk and Kevin Robinson, the case, you know, that case, the earlier case, really only had local attention. And so I was interested in, you know, placing it, placing the Shepherd case in a context. I can tell you, you know, something really fascinating, which is I was just in Laramie, Wyoming last week. And at the time that I wrote the book, I went to visit Kevin Robinson while he was incarcerated. And Kevin Robinson had always maintained he was innocent of that crime. And Kevin Robinson was just released from prison just in the last couple of months after serving 18 years. And I had not seen Kevin in a number of years, and I just had an opportunity to sit down and talk with him last week.
Wow, that is amazing. And Mr. Robinson, how old was he at the time that this murder took place?
You know, I'd have to go through my notes, but I would say Kevin was probably 30s, possibly 40s. And as I said, he served 18 years. He was sentenced he was given a very long prison sentence on multiple charges, but he was sentenced less than a month before the attack on Matthew Shepherd. So again, you had people that were involved in that case. Kevin Robin was sentenced. A few weeks later, Matthew Shepherd is found tied to the fence outside Laramie, and this whole new case begins that drew, you know, so much attention. So I was just, I was interested again, you know, when you, you know, on your show, when you talk about the context of white supremacy, I was interested in looking at the context of justice, the context of how a criminal case, how these two criminal cases were handled in Laramie.
One of the issues that comes up in the Matthew Shepherd case that also seems to be an issue with Kevin Robinson's ultimate conviction in this case, which you say he steadfastly has maintained that he's innocent. Police misconduct or perhaps a conflict of interest in police investigating. Was that an issue in Kevin Robinson's conviction?
Yes, I raised those questions. I certainly had questions after going through, a pretty extensive record in the case. After meeting Kevin and talking to other people around his case, and it's very interesting because what would happen is Kevin had an exemplary prison record, and so eventually over the last few years of his sentence, he was actually at a place in Wyoming called the Honor Farm because his record was so good. It's less than medium security. I guess you'd say it's a minimum security facility. And what would happen is the parole board would come to question Kevin, and Kevin, you know, basically they weren't willing to release him because they said he's not showing any remorse. So he was between a rock and a hard place because he was saying, I've always maintained I was innocent of this crime. And so finally, he has been released from prison and is trying to get his life back. But a very interesting fellow, and I'm actually considering doing some writing about his case as well.
Let's get that book, please. We would love to have you back on the program to discuss that as well, and maybe even to talk to him directly also. For additional context, I guess two-part question here. Number one, the demographics in terms of what's the percentage of the population that's white and black in this area of Wyoming? That's one, since this was a black male convicted of this crime. And then two, were there people that said, hey, I don't think Kevin Robinson got a just hearing. I think he was innocent, and I think he was unjustly convicted.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the exact percentage in terms of white white versus African American, but I can tell you this. There's a very small population of black people in Laramie. There's a considerably larger Latino population. There are a number of Mexicans and Mexican Americans in Laramie, but it's rare that you see African Americans in Laramie. So I can't tell you the exact percentage, Gus, but can tell you that it's low, and certainly, you know, questions around race came up in this case. As to your second question, there are a number of people in Laramie who believe Kevin Robinson was innocent, and that includes a number of people in the among the defense lawyers that practice regularly in the town. But you know, even ordinary people, the word sort of went out. It's a town of about 27,000-28,000 people. People spoke about it. You know, while I was working on Shepherd, I would hear it frequently that people believed that Kevin Robinson was innocent, that there was really nothing, you know, in terms of, you know, his previous life that indicated anything, you know, anything that would suggest, you know, violent behavior, previous felony convictions, or anything like that. And even the police seemed to have their doubts, because after Kevin was arrested for Daphne Salk's murder and he was being held in the county jail, he was allowed to leave the jail to go to an office Christmas party, and he was actually allowed to leave the jail. He was not really considered any kind of a safety or security risk. Well, that seems contradictory when you think of the fact that the murder victim was a 15-year-old girl who was pregnant. You know, if this was, you know, as heinous a crime as it's been described, and if Kevin Robinson was the person they suspected committed it, then he was allowed out of jail to go to his office Christmas party. So the case is full of a lot of questions, like a few of the ones I'm suggesting right now. But, you know, certainly even today, there are a number of people that have questions. In fact, that's why I met with Kevin, because I received a phone call from someone who was aware of my work on the Shepherd case and said, hey, would you be willing to take a second look at this? Because it really, you know, Kevin is still not only maintaining his innocence, but he'd like to do something to clear his name.
Good for Mr. Robinson. I wish him success in that. Just before we get to Matthew Shepherd's case, and again, some of the same characters that were involved in the Kevin Robinson case will reappear. And also, they did not do DNA testing since this 15, Miss Salkin, she was pregnant at the time that she was murdered. They did not do DNA testing because I think the part of the thesis was that Kevin Robinson did this because he impregnated her. He was upset about that, and he wanted her to get an abortion, and she seemed unwilling. So that was a part of his rage to kill her and the fetus. They did not do DNA testing to confirm that he was indeed the father, and they did get evidence that she had been having sexual intercourse with other adult males other than Kevin Robinson. So I thought that was important as well. You include that in the book.
It is very important, because there were actually a couple of other men, not just that the victim had, you know, Daphne had had sex with, but also that they had actually been arrested and did jail time for having had sex with a minor. So there were definitely other suspects. And as far as the business of DNA testing, the official story is that the sample that they took, again, she had only been pregnant for, she was pregnant, I believe they said, between 2 to 4 weeks. So it was very early in the pregnancy. It was claimed that the sample that they took was degraded and they couldn't properly test it. So there was never any clear identification that Kevin Robinson had fathered a child with her. That was never proven. A lot of the case was circumstantial. There was a couple of drops of Daphne Salk's blood found on the driver's side door in Robinson's vehicle and a little bit in the trunk. However, there you know, in what I've looked at, and it's been a while since I've looked deeply into the case. I've just started reading some of the record again, but it appears that at least one of the other suspects, whose name originally came up, may have had access to Kevin Robinson's car. There was a connection, a mutual friend who I believe had sold Kevin the car. So, you know, the fact that there was a small amount of blood, a lot of the other evidence in the case was circumstantial and even hearsay.
Wow. One of the central figures in the Matthew Shepard case, you can help me pronounce his last name, Cal, is it Raruca?
Raruca. Yes, Cal Raruca.
Cal Raruca, who was also involved with Kevin Robinson, prosecutor in the Kevin Robinson case, he said, this is in your book, you write, Raruca felt certain that Kevin Robinson was guilty of the most heinous kind of murder, killing a 15-year-old child who was helpless to defend herself. The physical evidence had only been strong enough to prosecute Robinson for manslaughter and assorted lesser charges. To Raruca, a devout Catholic, the lesser crime of soliciting sexual relations with a minor was not far behind taking another's life. In this case, two lives were taken since the victim, Daphne Sulk, was pregnant. Part of him wished the bastard, talking about Kevin Robinson, would rot in hell. What do you make of Robinson's commentary there?
Yeah, well, I've known Raruca, as I point out in the book, for a really long time, and actually just saw him recently as well. And what I want to say, just to be fair, is that, what happens often with prosecutors is that they're relying a lot, and this is not to let him off the hook, but they're relying on the information that the police and the detectives come up with in the case. So the thing is that I think that certainly in the attempt on Kevin Robinson's part to clear his name, if there is any new information that can be developed or anyone, you know, new information or sources come forward, I think Raruca would be very open about it. But I was being serious in what I said about, he is a devout Catholic, and, I think the issue of abortion for him would have been an issue that she was carrying a baby. So even though the baby, it was really very, very early in the pregnancy, we can't call it a baby. Nonetheless, I think that life, the crime was very violent. I mean, she had, many stab wounds, well over a dozen stab wounds. And again, just, taking her to the wilderness and burying her body in a forest, I talk in the book about how there was a couple that went out to collect pine cones in the forest to make homemade Christmas decorations when they stumbled onto Daphne Sulk's body. So it was not just the murder itself, but then the attempt to cover it up as well. So that it really did, there was something about the crime that really, it had an impact on this town. The news of it may have not gone beyond this town, but it was definitely felt there locally because of her age and the kind of crime it was.
Wow. Moving forward chronologically, Matthew Shepard, the way that this murder was reported in the mainstream media, just the narrative so that people can understand, 1998, this is October, the evening of October 6th going into the morning of October 7, 1998, the main principals, Matthew Shepard, the victim, Aaron McKinney, and Russell Henderson. Can you kind of give the way that you heard it, because you said you believed what the mainstream media reported about this as well, the way that you heard this story originally?
Sure. I'll just say what the accepted narrative was at the time, and in the book I give some excerpts from, leading publications, from the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, the Denver Post, Boston Globe, and basically the way it was reported was that two men, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, went into a bar in Laramie late one evening, and they saw Matthew Shepard in the bar. He was a stranger to them, and he looked well-dressed, and that basically they decided to focus on him. He looked gay, looked well-dressed, and they decided to focus on him to, the words were, to lure him out of the bar. And then proceeded to rob and beat him to death because he was gay. That story that was the initial narrative was later elaborated in many different fashions. Aaron McKinney's girlfriend, Kristen Price, told the media that what she had learned from Aaron was that while they were in the bar, Matthew Shepard made a pass at them, and that the reason they took him out of the bar, they were taking him out to beat him up, and in her words, to teach Matthew Shepard a lesson not to come on to straight people. As time went on, that story was elaborated further. Aaron McKinney himself claimed that it was not until after they left the bar and they got into the truck, that while they were in the truck, they had driven through the center of town. When they got to the other end of town, that Matthew Shepard grabbed Aaron McKinney on the leg or the crotch, and that's what caused him to explode. So the story was elaborated as time went on. There were these different versions, Gus. But when I began interviewing Kristen Price and ultimately Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson and a number of other people, Kristen Price acknowledged that she had lied at the time. And in fact, that first interview she did was with 2020. So when I did the piece in 2004, we were able to use that old piece from her interview where she admitted that she had lied outright and that the reason she did it was that she was trying to protect her boyfriend, Aaron McKinney. So that was some of the official narrative was that this had to do, that, you know, Matthew's gayness was at the heart of this. What I uncovered, you know, in summary form, is that, in fact, Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard knew each other very well. They'd known each other since the year prior to the murder. They'd known each other since sometime in 1997. And I was able to put together from a variety of sources a number of different, settings in which Aaron and Matthew had been together. They socialized together at parties. They, both used the drug methamphetamine, crystal meth. They had bought and sold the drug from each other. And in one instance, a boyfriend, a longtime boyfriend of Matthew's and friend, had actually been with Matthew at a bar with Aaron McKinney and another older male, and this again was the year before the murder. So there was a history that existed between Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard prior to this crime happening, and yet almost all the media said that that these guys were strangers. The one exception, there was a very fine journalist who wrote a piece for Harper's Magazine, Joanne Vipijeski, and she was suggesting that, there were indications that these guys knew each other before that night. But her piece came out before Aaron McKinney's trial, and just something that I think your listeners will be interested in, during the year that this case was making its way through the courts, all the witnesses in the case were under a gag order, a court-imposed gag order, and all the records in the case were sealed. So when I mentioned that a reporter published a piece before Aaron McKinney's trial, none of the documents were available for inspection by journalists, and a lot of the key witnesses and principals were unable to talk. So, journalists were relying on, a small number of press conferences and what they could pick up on the street. But nonetheless, what they picked up was what quickly became accepted as fact, even though, some of it came out really before the police had even completed an investigation. So I think that, what I have said in the book, what I've reported in the book, is that it's a very different story if you're talking about people that knew each other in it prior to that night, that they were not strangers. And also in the book, I trace, pre-existing conflict and discord that was there between Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard, that there had been conflict between them and that they knew each other quite well and had been intimate.
And when you say intimate, you mean some sort of sexual activity?
Yes, they had been sexually involved.
Right on. I know for me, this book, it reads very different given all the attention over the last, I would say, 2-3 years about the heroin epidemic and how that relates to the methamphetamine epidemic that has been going on for a while. It reads very different saying, oh, all of this had started some time ago. Even I think they say repeatedly in the book, we were about a decade behind in getting rolling on this. And man, we really should have started all this earlier. Like, I think a lot more people would, it wouldn't be that difficult for, I think, a lot of people to believe now that there is a major meth problem inflicting a lot of white people. And maybe that contributed to some element of this. I think that might.
Gus, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I can say that even when I started to look at the meth side of the story, back as early as, you know, 2003, 2004, it was a story, the meth story was not one that the national media was paying any serious attention to. And I would say that really, you know, you began to see significant meth stories, you know, around 2005, 2006. And then, of course, with the TV series Breaking Bad. But you're absolutely right. And one of the things that interested me is how this drug, at the time of Matthew's killing, about 80% of the meth, you know, being consumed in Wyoming was coming from Mexico or from Mexican-owned cartels, Mexican-run cartels in California. Is that, you know, the meth issue was not being, it was not really being looked at in the early 2000s, or certainly not in the late 90s when this happened to him. And it was also, had become an epidemic in the gay community. It was already a big problem in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, became very large. And you're absolutely right in what you're saying about heroin, is that, you know, people gradually started to pay more attention to meth. A new heroin epidemic came. And just while I was in Wyoming last week, you know, there's been kind of an upsurge again in meth use as they've tried to crack down on some of the precursor ingredients that go into making meth. As they've done that, there are new ways. It's coming into the country in new ways. And I actually spoke with Cal Verucca, and he has a big meth case that he's been dealing with recently. So that's true. And I also, you know, you mentioned the racial aspect, and I think that that is certainly, you know, is certainly a factor. I mean, we know over decades, we know of, you know, about various drug epidemics that have happened in cities in this country, in urban centers, and that, you know, it's taken sometimes a very long time before we've come to understand exactly either where the drugs have been coming from. You know, it's become a big problem, but there have been a lot of mysteries as to the origins of these drug problems. And sometimes they have not been reported in a timely fashion, and they're addressed much, much later.
You write in the book, I want to see if you think this is accurate. According to an article in the Denver Post, a few days after the attack on Matthew Shepard, Bill McKinney stated, "The news has already taken this up and blew it totally out of proportion because it involved a homosexual. Had this been a heterosexual, these two boys decided to take out and rob, this never would have made the national news." Is Mr. McKinney, is he accurate?
Well, okay, so what I want to do is I want to use some of your methodology, which has to do with context, okay? And the time when this murder happened, that year, 1998, was a time when the gay community was really feeling under siege, because you had on the right, the far right, the conservative religious right, you had the Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott basically saying that, you know, gay people should be treated like kleptomaniacs or alcoholics, you know, and, you know, that homosexuality was a sin, and, you know, in terms of the Bible. Pat Robertson at that time, that spring, made the statement about, you know, homosexuality is the last step in the decline of Western Gentile civilization. And so, you know, and the gay community is being confronted with billboards telling them about, you know, how if they go to, you know, a weekend workshop or to therapy for a while, that they're going to be converted, you know, they're going to be changed and become straight. So the gay community was feeling very, very much under siege. And so what I want to say about Bill McKinney's comment is that I would not dismiss what Bill McKinney said out of hand. I think you have to look at the context of the culture wars that were going on at the time and how politicized things were. I can say as a gay man, at that time, I was really offended by, you know, some of these notions that, you know, because I was gay, I was socially inferior, or I'm like a kleptomaniac or whatever else it is. So at the time, with the gay community being under siege, when this crime happened, Matthew Shepard became, you know, it was as if he was, you know, made perfectly as an icon. He became a perfect martyr for a cause. But, you know, as a gay man, for, you know, and a journalist who believes that truth matters and the truth is important regardless of the circumstances, I believe, you know, it behooves all of us as human beings, to understand what really happened. We're either serious about preventing other tragedies like this from happening, or we're not serious. So if we're serious, then, you know, then we have to look at what other factors took part, you know, what other factors played a role in this crime. And that includes methamphetamine. It includes, what may have been going on, some things that were going on with local law enforcement. It includes the national political scene. As you know, Gus, in the book, I talk about where Bill Clinton was, you know, at the time this crime happened. He was right in the middle of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and was literally, the week that this happened and the week following it, he was dealing with impeachment proceedings. So, again, I just want to say, let's look at all the players, okay, and let's see the context. Let's not just look at Bill McKinney and say Bill McKinney is an inferior, ignorant human being who made that statement. I think you could say, you know, we could replace that and say, you know, the reason someone's getting all the attention is because they're white. In this case, Matthew Shepard. Okay, and I think there's truth to that. I mean, let's look at this. The James Byrd Jr. dragging death in Jasper, Texas, happened just a few months before Matthew was attacked. So there's sensitivity to hate crime, but yet, at the end of the day, okay, you know, in retrospect, certainly, certainly the James Byrd murder was a racially motivated crime, okay? And yet, you know, it's the Matthew Shepard Act, the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Act, or whatever the exact phrasing of it is. And I couldn't help but notice that that Matthew Shepard's name came first there. And you know, so I guess what I'm saying is, couldn't we substitute what Bill McKinney said and said, if this didn't happen to a white person, right, would it have gotten all the attention? And I think we know the answer to that, don't we?
I certainly have my view on it. And you, okay. You actually, your response, you actually took a question right out of my mouth, because I have looked at that. I can even share truthfully, even before I read your book, I did not know anywhere near as much detail about this. And I know people, it's controversial, as they say, it's disputed or what have you, but I myself thought just, and I was taking it on face value, that that's what happened. Matthew Shepard was killed because he was gay. I took what they said. Even with that, I said, wow, how is it that his name is first on this list, not even alphabetical? If we were going to do it alphabetical, James Byrd Jr.'s name would be first. And I said,
that's right.
In my view, that right there is a massive act of racism. Now, looking after I read your book, I said, whoa, I don't even think his name should be there at all. That making sure people, hey, I think what happened to Matthew Shepard, that is horrendous. That should not happen to anyone for any reason. But if what you have reported in this book is accurate, this is not a hate crime at all. His name shouldn't be there at all. If we want to have something that is about methamphetamine, maybe, or drug use, which is equally important, then that would be a worthy cause to say, hey, if drugs...
I've encountered a lot of opposition for really presenting, you know, key facts in this case that were not known or understood at the time. But again, you know, we're in the state we're in part right now in America because the media has not done its job. And I really feel that if a case is going to have this kind of national significance, then we really need to understand it as fully as we can. And I'm not saying that what I've written is the last word. Someone else may come, other people may come, and they may find out new facts that I didn't know. But the point is let's do our job as journalists and really try to get to the bottom of what the factors are. And again, you know, going back to Kevin Robinson for a minute, I don't know all the facts in Kevin Robinson's case, but I do know that there are some questions that even now, all these years later, they really need to be answered.
Hmm. And just based on the more than a decade of research that you've done, do you think it's accurate, me saying that Matthew Shepard's name should not be on the hate crime bill at all, since he was not the victim of a hate crime? No one was charged in a hate crime in his murder. That was not one of the charges that was alleged against Russell Henderson or Aaron McKinney?
That's correct. And, you know, it's something that that has troubled me is that, you know, people that have a different view would say, well, there wasn't a hate crime, a federal hate crime law at the time, okay? Well, that's true, but you don't retroactively redefine something just because the media characterized it as a hate crime. That's not what these guys were convicted of. And, you know, while we're on the subject of, you know, mentioning my recent visit to Laramie, you know, I saw Russell Henderson. I visit him a couple of times a year in prison. And, you know, I say to people, I mean, what am I, a fool? I'm a gay man, and I'm going to be go visiting a guy in prison that I think hates gay people? Russell Henderson, is no more homophobic than anyone else is. He is not a homophobe, but that's how he was characterized. And there was he had no motive, okay, to do anything to hurt Matthew Shepard. You know, he was responsible for, you know, he's responsible for being in the wrong place at the wrong time and going along with this convoluted plan that Aaron McKinney had. He was a participant. But as far as him having any motive that was homophobic, you know, you're not going to convince me of that. I've known these guys. I started interviewing them in 2012. So I've known Russell for 14 years. And I would never waste my time going to visit this guy in prison if I thought that he hated gay people.
I just wanted to make sure if we got an accurate answer to that question. Would it be accurate then to say that Matthew Shepard's name should not be on the hate crime bill since he was not a victim of a hate crime, according to the research you've done?
Yeah, well, you know, Gus, it's a really good question, and you're taking me into another area around hate crimes in terms of even how hate crimes are understood and defined. When this hate crime bill was, moving through, you know, it was a long road getting it passed. I was not in favor of a federal hate crime legislation because I felt that it was doubly penalizing someone. In other words, if there's evidence that someone committed a murder, okay, and they're going to get the death penalty for that murder, do we really need to add a double death penalty because we believe we understand what was going on in that person's mind when they committed the crime? And the Shepard case is an example to me of a case where we really don't know what was going on in their mind. And so, you know, I'd have to take a step back and say, I'm not even sure that we needed this legislation to begin with, okay? And then as to the second question, the way I would answer it and say, at the very least, James Byrd's name should have come first.
That still didn't exactly sound like a yes or no. I heard James should come first, not whether or not Matthew Shepard's name should be there at all.
Okay, so let's look at the complexity and the context then for a moment, all right? Aaron McKinney, right, he was closeted, okay? He was a bisexual guy at the time of this crime. He had a girlfriend. He was living with his girlfriend, and they had an infant son, okay? So he was living a closeted life, and he had clearly experimented, you know, with guys, including Matthew. He had been a hustler, a male prostitute, okay? And, you know, that's part of Aaron McKinney's history. But he was in the closet, okay? So a lot of people would say if someone's in the closet, they're there in the closet for some reason. Either they don't like that part of themselves, or they're fearful of the consequences, or whatever it is. Just in the time since 1998, when this crime happened, there's a lot less discomfort with the notion of bisexuality. Okay, people talk, you know, people have a more of a comfort level with it now that they didn't have before. But so, is there in Aaron McKinney something that was uncomfortable with his bisexuality being understood or known by others? Clearly, it was. But as far as this crime is concerned, we have to go to the issue of what motivated him to go following Matthew Shepard from bar to bar that night, looking for him, and trying to, you know, sit down, you know, have a sit down with Matthew Shepard. And it was around drugs and money, okay? But what I'm saying is there anti-gay hate out there? Is there racial hatred, which clearly was the, I mean, it's a case in many, many instances, and certainly in the James Byrd case. So what I'm saying is, I want to separate the notion of hate crime, okay, from the hate crime legislation and the hate crime law. Do I believe that someone can be motivated to kill someone because of their race or their sexual orientation? Absolutely. But in the case of that specific law, I think, you know, the part of me that's interested in justice has problems around, I believe that we already have draconian prison sentences, okay? And the idea that someone's going to get a double life sentence, or they're going to get a life sentence and an additional 10 years because, lawyers and prosecutors are going to decide that there was a particular motivation, I'm not sure that that's serving a free society.
Hmm. You have a passage in the book here where you write, this is Prosecutor Cal Ruchka, you say Cal Ruchka was right. News of the appalling crime on the Wyoming prairie spread nationally and internationally in a matter of hours. People everywhere were stunned by reports that a boyish-looking all-American college student had been beaten savagely and hung on a fence because he was gay. More significantly, an outraged gay community mobilized immediately. What did that mobilization look like? And specifically, you cite two individuals, Walt Bolden, Alex Trout, who are also seem to be like they were key instigators in this promoting this idea that this was a hate crime that happened to Matthew Shepard.
That's right. Well, so just to give you a little understanding, or your listeners, Walt Bolden was an older fellow who had met Matthew around the time Matthew was 15 and had kind of mentored him. The other fellow, Alex Trout, was Matthew's age. And what happened is they were notified. Once Matthew's family was notified that Matthew had been severely beaten, was taken to the hospital, Matthew Shepard's father called Walt Bolden. And Walt Bolden and Alex Trout went to the hospital in Fort Collins, Colorado, where Matthew had been taken. The police had done, at this point, minimal investigation. They started calling. They called some local media in Wyoming, specifically the Casper Star Tribune, where Matthew had a friend who was working there as a reporter by the name of Jason Marsden. Today, Jason Marsden is the executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. Word went out to the Associated Press from the Casper Star Tribune, and in addition, Walt Bolden and Alex Trout called gay organizations in Wyoming and in Colorado, okay, to let them know their belief that this had been an anti-gay lynching. And so very, very quickly, the word went out to other gay organizations, and within a couple of days, there were protests and demonstrations and vigils being held all over the country. I mean, the big one in New York, in San Francisco, there were vigils all over the place. There was a vigil outside the hospital while Matthew was still alive. So that narrative that began in part from the two friends of Matthew that played a big role in it. The first press conference that was held, when the sheriff in Albany County spoke to journalists, when journalists, you know, descended on the town, you know, someone asked a question, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, was it a crucifixion? Well, you know, the sheriff's answering, well, you know, from the way his hands were spread out, you know, hanging on the fence or whatever, I guess you could say that. Well, very quickly, this narrative got shaped about, you know, Matthew was hung on a fence, beaten to death, hung on a fence like a scarecrow because he was gay. And in fact, he was never hung up on the fence like that. When he was found, he was sitting on the ground with his hands tied behind his, you know, behind him, and the rope was tied to the bottom of a fence post, okay? But nonetheless, that didn't stop the image of him literally being crucified, hanging on this barbed wire fence. So there were many, many details that were gotten wrong at the time. You know, I just, you could get me to go on and on about a lot of the details and how they were misrepresented and perceived inaccurately. Is there a particular aspect, Gus, that you'd like me to focus on?
Well, I guess number one, the image I saw in doing your, this is not in your book, but as I was just kind of going back and looking at some of the references that you talked about and that sort of thing, I think Time Magazine at the time, they had a front story that said the war on gays, and they had a picture of the fence where this falsely reported crucifixion took place of Matthew
yes.
Shepard at the time. I mean, just stunning imagery. I don't even know if I could totally say that this was the gay mobilization, because it seemed like a lot of folks in the mainstream media participated in this, all the way up to the White House with Bill Clinton participating in this. Some of these people
yes.
obviously having their own motivations for why they did this, but it just seemed like an, I mean, it continues. It is an awesome demonstration of force in saying that we are not going to tolerate this, that there is an attack on gays, and we're going to mobilize politically, and that includes trying to get legislation passed and all of that, and to see that these individuals are punished to the fullest extent of the law. What type of pushback, and I do have specifics on this, what type of pushback was a part of this mobilization, when I mean pushback, in terms of people either trying to come out and say, well, this was not a hate crime, that this might have had something to do with drugs, and people saying that we're not going to talk about that, we're not going to report that, and later even...
Well, at the time, Gus, there was almost no mention of drugs. I mean, I've gone, you know, done a pretty thorough review of a lot of the articles that came out all over the country, as well as TV reports, and there were just, you know, a couple of mentions that, you know, friends of, you know, Aaron McKinney or Russell Henderson or their girlfriends had said that, you know, a couple of them might have been into using crank, as they called it then. But it really was not explored by any of the, you know, any of the big media in terms of looking at the drug aspect of it. That's something that didn't come out until much later. Now, by the time of Aaron McKinney's trial a year later, his attorneys raised the issue of Aaron McKinney's drug use, that he'd been using meth, but they didn't go into in any kind of, you know, serious way that Aaron McKinney had been addicted to crystal meth for 3 years, that he'd been selling it for 3 years, that he had, you know, that he had made it, made at least one trip that I know of to a California meth lab, that he'd been really involved with it, and some of the other players that he was involved with were serious players. And also, that's true of Matthew Shepard. Matthew got involved with meth, you know, while he was living in Denver. He'd only been living in Laramie a short time. Some of the people that he got involved with in Denver came from Laramie. It's less than 2.5 hours, Laramie is, you know, from Denver. And so when Matthew moved to Laramie to start school at the University of Wyoming, some of the people he was involved with kind of set him up so that he could, you know, he could do some selling of meth when he was in Laramie. And again, these are people that, you know, I've interviewed when I was doing the story for ABC News for 2020. My partner, my producing partner, Glenn Silber, and I interviewed several of the people, several of the dealers involved, okay, on both sides, on Matthew's side and on Aaron's side. And, you know, we checked out their records. I mean, these are people, some of them who have been arrested, incarcerated on meth trafficking charges and meth dealing charges. And these were some of the people, unfortunately, that Matthew had gotten involved with while living in Denver, and Aaron McKinney had been involved with for 3 years prior to the crime.
Hmm. When you made your effort to present some of this material in the documentary for ABC, the special, the one-hour special on 2020,
yes.
Was there an effort by this gay mobilization to either discredit or edit out some of the material that you were going to produce?
Yes. They several gay organizations contacted ABC News, the some of the top executives there, and they were attempting to smear me in a variety of ways, and essentially, you know, one organization wanted to be given access to the, they wanted to see an edited version of the program prior to broadcast so they could give feedback. To ABC News's credit, they wouldn't consent to that, that they wanted to remain independent in terms of reporting. I mean, ultimately, their attempts to smear me did not work either, but they were trying to come up with, you know, all kinds of, you know, contrived stories about, you know, that someone had brought the story to ABC News. It wasn't me. It was crazy because, you know, Glenn Silber is a producer at ABC News that I had known him by reputation for years, and we had mutual friends, and I had been talking with Glenn for months, you know, while I was still working on the New York Times Magazine story. So it was me who brought the story to them. But they were kind of grasping at straws, and the argument was that this is going to set gay rights back. This is going to damage. This is going to damage the cause of gay rights. And you know, I wasn't buying into that. First of all, you know, as I point out in the book, I mean, I have been active around gay issues since the 70s. You know, marched on the first gay march in Washington in 1979. Was involved in, you know, doing things during, you know, helping to raise awareness, raise money during the AIDS era. So the idea that people were deciding what's good for gay rights and what's not, and my argument right along was the truth is the best thing for gay rights, and the best thing, you know, the truth versus spin, versus political spin, the truth matters more, and that we are entitled to the complexity of who we are as human beings. We don't need, okay, we don't need a myth or a fable or an iconography of around martyrdom in order for our cause to be a just one.
I think an aspect of that, as you call it, myth-making and evading the truth. And I kind of look at these two cases in parallel, the Matthew Shepard case and James Byrd Jr., who was killed same
yes.
year in Jasper, Texas. We talked about that case on this program before. I know with James Byrd Jr., there seemed to be no hesitation or problem about going into any of his sordid background, criminal history, times he was drunk, and report even that he was under the influence of alcohol at the time that he was accosted and killed. No problem, no hesitation. And even they have a documentary, Two Towns of Jasper, where they talk to some of the white residents. And they say specifically, you know, I'm not interested in having James Byrd lionized as though he was some hero. I remember him sitting around drinking Thunderbird all the time. I'm not here to pretend like he was some saint or what have you. No problem doing that. With Matthew Shepard, they
yep.
sealed his criminal records, where you talk about in the book, where he's alleged to have done some sort of sexual misconduct to some young children, and
yes.
other aspect, even the drug aspect, which, you know, I mean, hey, that could be talked about. That, in my opinion, that's not something to demonize someone, but in my view, I think that's massive. Just, can you talk about this effort to conceal and protect some of the less, I guess, glorifying or positive aspects of Matthew Shepard?
Yeah, well, you know, and again, I think different parties in the case had different reasons and different motives. You know, I think politically, you know, certainly people that were trying to move the hate crimes bill forward or to try to use Matthew in advancing, you know, a political cause, they certainly did not want those facts coming out. I think in the case of the prosecutor, I think that one of his fears from very early on was the possibility of a mistrial, because, you know, it's always a concern when there are a lot of journalists involved in a case, or if there are cameras in the courtroom and, you know, it becomes a big television spectacle, that then the issue is going to get raised. Can there be justice for the accused, et cetera? So I think, again, you have to kind of look at it from, you know, simultaneously from a few different angles. However, it's troubling to me. It's not, you know, as you pointed out at the beginning, Gus, what happened to Matthew, whether pieces of it were mythologized or fictionalized, it was still, you know, a fatal beating. You know, what he suffered led to his death, and it was a horribly violent crime. But the question is, did that horribly violent crime happen because Aaron McKinney was motivated by homophobia to crush Matthew's skull, or was he on a, you know, was he on a meth-induced rage, having been up on meth for an entire week, mixing it with cocaine, owing everyone money, etc.? So, you know, I think you're raising a great question about Matthew's background, and again, I think if you're trying to understand the crime, then understanding the people involved is very important. What, you know, what, this was a tragedy, and it was a tragedy for more than one person, and what brought about the tragedy that night? You know, why was Aaron McKinney looking for Matthew Shepard? Why did Russell Henderson go along, you know, with Aaron McKinney's robbery plan, and what resulted? But, you know, I'll mention something that I think your listeners might be interested in hearing. Aaron McKinney, okay, attacked four men in a 24-hour period. The worst of those attacks was on Matthew Shepard. But the night before, this crime happened on a Tuesday night. On Monday night, in the middle of the night, or the early morning hours on Tuesday, Aaron McKinney broke into his cousin's apartment in Laramie looking for a guy who he had sold drugs to in the past, in fact, someone that I spoke with, and he attacked him, lunged at him, because he was claiming that this guy owed him money for drugs, and a couple of other guys that were there in the house had to pull him off, this fellow, okay? So during the beating of Matthew Shepard, Russell Henderson tries to stop him, and Aaron McKinney takes the gun and strikes Russell Henderson across the face, right above his mouth. Russell Henderson gets 9 stitches that night. They leave Matthew Shepard tied to the fence, and they go into town, and literally minutes later, they get into a fight with 2 Hispanic kids, and Aaron McKinney again goes and gets the gun from the truck and cracks the skull with the gun of one of the Hispanic kids. And he had he was treated also at the emergency room that night, stitches right across the top of his skull. So how do you, given Aaron McKinney's state of mind, how do you isolate one of those attacks from the other 3 and say this was an anti-gay hate crime when, in fact, Aaron McKinney attacked 4 males in that 24-hour period?
Mm.
The other 3 males were straight, by the way.
Wow. Needing over 20 staples, the one, as you say, Hispanic male in the book that you write about. He didn't even know them. They just walked up on them and saw them vandalizing vehicles and, you know, right on, let's get to some more violence. You have a lot of intriguing information in the book about Bill Clinton and his involvement with this case all the way from the White House. I thought this was a just stunning passage where you write, when Bill Clinton later compared Matthew Shepard's murder to genocide in Bosnia, I admired him for telling what I thought was an unvarnished truth. At the time, I never gave it a second thought that Matthew's accused assailants had already been found guilty of a hate crime in the court of public opinion, even before they were arraigned for the murder. The president also let it be known that he favored the death penalty for both men. That right there is stunning, in my opinion. I would have flipped out just to have a sitting president weigh in and say that he favors the death penalty when you have not even been arraigned for a crime. If I had an attorney that was worth anything, I would have been jumping up and down and saying there's no way I will be able to get a just trial at all if the president of the United States has said he favors the death penalty and we haven't even been arraigned. Just, can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, you know, yes, and this morning, Gus, I was reading, you know, I was reading a number of articles and looking at quite a few videos on Bill Clinton's meeting a few days ago with the Attorney General for a half an hour, in a plane in Phoenix, and the questions it raises. And I think that whatever other qualities we can attribute to Bill Clinton, I think that that's certainly part of his political style. And you know, the way I came to understand it around Shepard was, Bill Clinton let his views be known through Janet Reno, the Attorney General. Janet Reno would then communicate with the U.S. Attorney in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and then, those views would be then conveyed to Cal Ruka. For the first couple of weeks of this case, the federal government was considering the possibility of having a federal prosecutor handle the case. And that federal prosecutor who was going to handle the case is still working as a federal prosecutor in Wyoming. And he knows that this was not an anti-gay hate crime. It's interesting when you raise the issue about Bill Clinton. First of all, from everything I learned about this case, it's beyond spin or rhetoric. But to compare this to genocide, whether you call it, say genocide in Bosnia or genocide in Rwanda or wherever it is, that's an extreme statement. And, I had admiration for Ted Kennedy, but I remember he referred to this in the early years when they were trying to get the Matthew Shepard Act passed, the hate crime, they called it then. I think it was the hate crimes, law enforcement enhancement. I can't even remember the names. It had many names over the years. But Ted Kennedy referred to the attack on Matthew Shepard as a form of terrorism. And, there's rhetoric, but Bill Clinton's was over the top. And, one might think that Bill Clinton's style has not changed all that much over the years. The only thing is he's not the president anymore.
Hmm. What do you make of this comparison, Matthew Shepard, on what happened to him? Sean Patrick Maloney, you mentioned earlier, who became the executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, him saying that this case, be careful in how you tread, I think is the way he phrased it, be careful in how you tread in reporting.
Well, just to clear up, Sean Maloney was the counsel to the Matthew Shepard Foundation and is now a congressman from a district in New York State. The person that I mentioned earlier was Jason Marsden, and if I erroneously said Sean Maloney, I meant to say Jason Marsden was the reporter who is now the executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, who Matthew's friends called on the phone. I just wanted to clear that up. But take me back to your question, guys.
Oh, for sure. I appreciate the clarification. I want to make sure we have that. Actually,
sure.
Sean Patrick Maloney, counsel to the Matthew Shepard Foundation, him saying, tread carefully in how you report the facts, details about this case. This is our, meaning the gay community's, Emmett Till. We pay a lot of attention to metaphors on this program. What do you make of that comparison?
I think it's a false comparison. I think it does no one any service to use this kind of hyperbole and everything else. I think the facts of what happened with Emmett Till, that is the Emmett Till case, and the idea, it sounds like clever ideas people came up with at a meeting. Oh, wouldn't it help our cause if we compared him to Emmett Till? Well, that's baloney, okay? And first of all, again, as a gay man, the cause for civil rights for all Americans, and in this case, we're talking about gay rights, that cause was a just one, okay, long before the Matthew Shepard case happened, and it was not dependent or contingent in any way on the Matthew Shepard case happening. So I think it's a false comparison. As you know, I'm critical in the book for him saying that. I can also tell you and tell your listeners that we never heard from Maloney about the book. I mean, I was saying, I was reporting something there about attempts to smear me to the television network, to ABC News, and to continue to push this agenda around Matthew's killing. I think you might may be interested in knowing that after the book came out, an organization that really, you know, launched a smear campaign against me is one that has close ties to the Clintons. It's called Media Matters for America, or Media Matters. And that group, you know, alleged media watchdog organization, you know, published nine articles on me in the book. They never wanted to interview me. They never wanted to actually have any facts presented to them, you know. And so, you know, Media Matters was founded by David Brock, a close Clinton ally. And so, you know, the people that were upset with me for writing the book, they didn't come forward. I mean, on numerous occasions, I said, I'll debate anyone with a knowledge of this case about the facts. And they never took me up on it. It was, what they did was, you know, certainly the book was ignored in some mainstream media quarters like the New York Times or the Washington Post. But it was a smear campaign to try to discredit me and the book. And clearly it was politically motivated. And this included, this went even to the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, was chastising me for having written the book. And I know that in the case of a professor of journalism at NYU, someone from the Southern Poverty Law Center wrote to this professor saying, why are you supporting, like, basically shame on you for supporting this guy's journalism. And the journalism professor, you know, responded by saying, I really reviewed Steve's sources, and I reviewed what he reported in the book carefully, and I think that his conclusions in the book are accurate and true. But again, it's when politics interferes with journalism. And, you know, I think this is something that I know I don't have to tell you about, because, again, just the whole notion of the context of white supremacy. When you look at the context of where power is held in the society and the stories that are told and the power that gets maintained through the telling of those stories, you know, this is something we see in so many areas of American life. And I don't think the media has done a fraction of the job they should to really look at that.
You write in the book, you talk about some of the experiences that Matthew Shepard had prior to being murdered, where you say this incident he had in Morocco. His parents, they ended up working and living overseas in Saudi Arabia. He spent time there as well, that he experienced, he reported that he was raped while he was in Morocco, that he was raped six times, yeah. And that this had a dramatic effect on him. You do also include in the book that there was at least one incident where Matthew Shepard, he reported to the police what seemed to be a fabricated report that he was sexually assaulted while he was back here in the States. He went to the hospital. There was no evidence that he had been sexually abused, sexually assaulted in any way, and the police didn't follow up on it because there was no evidence then. Then he said he was under the influence of alcohol, so he couldn't remember details clearly. Did you have any suspicions that the rape in Morocco might have been fabricated as well?
Well, you know, I did not have hard information, so I'm always really careful, because for me as a journalist, I try to not only have things, I want things supported and corroborated by multiple sources. What I can say is that in asking a number of people that were close to Matthew about the Morocco incident, there were different versions of the story that different people had heard from him. And certainly several of the people indicated that there had been a night of, that there had been partying involved, and possibly in Morocco, partying involved, and possibly some cocaine, and that what happened, just as what happened stateside, that it was not clear cut in the way it was, you know, it was not clear cut in the way it was described. As far as the incident that happened stateside with Matthew, which was in Cody, Wyoming, and involved him, you know, coming on to a bartender, a straight bartender. You know, I interviewed the bartender. I read all the available documents. I looked at that pretty carefully, and it does seem as if Matthew's state of mind played a big role in what was going on. I can't speculate that any of this had anything to do with Morocco. Some people said, he made this up because he was traumatized by what happened to him in Morocco. I can't say that because I don't know that to be true. I can say that he certainly had a troubled state of mind, and I think that, you know, that we know from some of the, you know, struggling with alcohol and struggling with, you know, drugs and, you know, other things that had happened to Matthew during his life, is that he was one of the chapter titles in the book was a term that Dennis Shepherd, Matthew's father, used, the bad karma kid, is that Matthew, you know, he got himself into some very, very messy situations. And certainly the one that happened in Cody, Wyoming, was a very messy situation. But what bothered me was when, you know, some of the, some of the mainstream media publications got a hold of that information, they again portrayed it to support the accepted narrative that Matthew was a chronic victim and that he was always being victimized because he was gay. Well, when you look at the incident that happened in Cody, okay, yes, Matthew ultimately got punched, but if you follow the story of what the police said and what the witnesses actually said, apparently he got drunk and he came on to someone very aggressively, and the person, you know, basically punched him, you know, to stop it, that it was an unwanted advance.
At several advances, I think, from your book, this person, it wasn't like he did this one time and the person just hauled off and socked him. He had done this several times.
Right. He kept talking to him. There were suggestive remarks going back and forth. And after the guy had said no, you know, it was like no, he then reached over, and touched him or grabbed him or whatever. And it reeled out of control from there.
Right. One of our listeners read your book in advance. I was telling them that you were going to be on the program, and so they read your book as well. And one of the points that they made, Lewis McKenzie, this is a former lover of Matthew Shepherd. He's a black male. You have a photograph of him in the book. They met in North Carolina. When Matthew Shepherd is killed, he was in the hospital. He didn't die immediately. They had him on life support and what have you. So Mr. McKenzie, he comes to see Matthew. He gets to the hospital. You write in the book, unofficial at Podre Valley Hospital wouldn't allow him to see Matthew, presumably due to stricter visiting policy for non-family members, and despite Lewis's explanation of his close relationship to Matthew. Lewis said he tried not to take it personally, yet he suddenly found himself adrift in a large crowd of strangers outside the hospital. The listener who read that said that, there were other non-family members who were there, and they were allowed to visit Matthew. I think Tina...
That's absolutely true. I think that, Lewis and Matthew met when Matthew began college as a freshman the first time in North Carolina. And, I think that relationship, in some circles was not viewed in a positive way, but I can say that I have found Lewis to be very credible, a smart guy and extremely honest in his recollections of Matthew. And, I certainly stand by the reporting where Lewis is concerned. I think it's very surprising that at that moment when Lewis made the trip, all the way there to try to see him at the hospital, that he was excluded and not allowed in because there were quite a few other people.
Before I even get to the question, you said the relationship between Lewis McKenzie and Matthew Shepherd was not viewed positively. Why was that?
Yeah. Well, I think, over time, and I think it's something we still deal with, is, the racism around, relationships, interracial relationships. But again, we're going back, this would have been, 1996. and you know, as it was in 1996, I'm sure going to a college in North Carolina, that you know, just a gay relationship between a freshman and an older student there, that in itself, the gay relationship would have been you know, already looked at, but I think the interracial aspect of it certainly would have been something else. So I think that it was that. I can't, you know, I don't know how Matthew's family viewed it, but I know that that Lewis has not really had any kind of significant contact with the family, that he was not, you know, he was not not really considered as someone that was close to the family. He did go to Matthew's memorial service, but not, you know, not as someone who was, you know, given a pass to go into the church. There were people that were given out passes to go to the memorial, and then there were people that watched it, you know, watched it on closed circuit from another location. But Lewis, you know, Lewis had been close to Matthew, as you can see. You know, you can see from the picture, you know, a visual like that speaks a thousand words. You can see, even in the photo, that there was a real connection between the two of them, and you can see it in Lewis's journal entries and his recollections of Matthew, that there was a real relationship there. I recently saw a video of the two of them that someone sent me that's on YouTube, and I had been looking for it for the longest time and couldn't find it. And it's when the two of them were in college together, and I believe, I can't remember if it was, not Jesse Helms, it was, no, it wasn't Trent Lott, it was, the wife of a well-known Republican senator who was also, she was somewhat involved in politics. She came to the school to give a speech, and Matthew Shepard and Lewis were interviewed by a reporter outside about the visit to the school of these. And so you could see the two of them, as they're talking, one is sort of finishing the sentences of the other. So any suggestion that Lewis, you know, had not been close to Matthew, you know, it's crazy. I mean, they had a closeness then, and they stayed in touch right through the fall when Matthew was killed. I know this through friends of Matthew who were present when Matthew spoke with Lewis on the phone, but Lewis was certainly not accorded a place in terms of anything that happened after Matthew was killed.
Wow. The listener's question was, do you think, well, it was applying just to the hospital aspect, but I guess also in terms of him not getting a pass for some of the memorial services as well, do you think that that could have been an act of racism, him not being allowed at the hospital, them saying that they had these strict rules, and I guess maybe even applying to the passes as well?
Jesus, Gus, is that a question? I mean, you know, I think, you know, you have to imagine for a second, you know, Wyoming. You know, this is a state, it's one of the, you know, the least populated states in the country. What, 450,000 people in the entire state? There are not many African Americans in Wyoming, okay? And so, you mix an incident, an incident of this magnitude that is drawing the interest of the President of the United States and Congress people and everything else, and you mix in, oh, all of a sudden, you know, it turns out that a couple of years before, when Matthew was in college, that he had a black lover and boyfriend. So let's put it this way. If there's not some explicit racism, I would say there's certainly some that's implicit.
Hmm. The passage, this is about Aaron McKinney after he's incarcerated, and you even add more context to this in saying, I think you already mentioned that he was not happy about having it revealed that he was bisexual, had been involved in some sort of homosexual activity, certainly being in greater confinement. You do not want that to get around. That could, you know, have you in some unpleasant situations, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
But you write where he's in jail and he's bragging, he's making autographs where he's calling himself killer, and he bragged to a fellow inmate's wife, being very drunk and homophobic, I flipped out and began to pistol whip the fag with my gun. You continue comments. Mm-hmm. Comments like the latter, along with his use of the epithets fag and queer in his statement to police, only served to reinforce Aaron's image as an unqualified homophobe. But these were also calculated attempts on his part to deflect attention from a side of himself that he was determined to keep hidden. In reality, Aaron had long been enamored with the bad boy attitudes celebrated in gangster rap and had used similar epithets with his friends, sporting a bandana, oversized cargo pants, and a thick chain around his check with the name, nickname Dopey engraved in solid gold. He'd call them bitch, nigga, ho, etc. And when I heard all of that in the gangster rap and what have you, it very much to me sounded like imitating black people, and that the whole passage, it kind of stood out because it was connected to him using some of these homophobic slurs. And I think often, at least what I hear, is that gangster rap or hip hop or whatever people want to call it is very misogynistic, very homophobic, with the use of the same type of slurs and associating that with black people. That him acting like a black person was a part of this persona, him being homophobic and how he wanted to portray himself. And again, in context, that this might have been a part of a ruse to make sure that he's not being subjected to unwanted sexual attention while he's in greater confinement. But just if you could respond in terms to this persona, it seems very much like he's acting, quote unquote, like a black, a stereotypical representation of a black person and all this homophobia and what he's wearing and what have you.
Yeah, well, sure, Gus. And I want to just say that, and I hope that in your reading of it, I didn't mean myself to stereotype than him. What I was trying to suggest is that, you know, there is a certain kind of an alienation in McKinney, okay, and a certain kind of personality, whether you want to say there was an element of the outsider. He kind of thrived on that, but he also used it to manipulate people. But what I'm saying is the kind of music that he really liked and what he chose to do, like, you know, he would, you know, the gold chain is one thing, but he felt that he was kind of imitating some of his hip-hop heroes when he was doing that. And I did not mean to be stereotyping the image of those artists, just saying that this is something that Aaron McKinney thought he was doing. He kind of viewed himself as being a bit of a small-town celebrity. He kind of liked, just as I mentioned in the book about him signing an autograph killer, he kind of liked the idea of, you know, kind of being, you know, a drug dealer in a small town. He liked hiring the limousine and partying in the limousine and treating people to drugs and a ride in the limousine and partying as if he was a celebrity. And, you know, the odd thing is, again, if you take Matt Shepard, who, you know, again, you know, was a victim of a horrible crime. But Matt also, there was an aspect of that. He liked getting the limousine. He liked pulling up at the disco in Fort Collins, Colorado, and getting out of a stretch limousine as if he were a celebrity. And I think this has a lot to do with the kind of signals that come out of this celebrity-driven culture we're in, that signaling to young people that this is how they find a place to belong is by imitating the rich and famous, whoever they are, whether it's a Hollywood movie star or a hip-hop musician. You know, that, and I think it took on very different forms. I think in Aaron McKinney's case, he, you know, this was just the kind of music he liked. And even on the night of the crime, I can't remember the name of the song, but when he went into the Fireside Bar that night, he went over to the DJ and asked for a hit song to be played by, I forget the hip-hop song, I can't remember the name of it. But again, I think it was just something that he was aspiring to some kind of fame and celebrity, but in my opinion anyway, in a very kind of vacuous way.
Logical. I wanted to ask you, and particularly with all of your research on this and the homophobia aspect, one of the things that we brought up on this program over the years, it's been my observation that black people, and it seems to be exclusively black people, I don't hear this apply to any other group on a racial basis, and it's worldwide. It's not even just black people here in the States, that black people are specifically, uniquely homophobic. And I've seen this play out in a myriad of different ways. They just had a new documentary on PBS within the last 2 years called The New Black, where they were basically showing this with lots of young black people. They did not want to go support gay marriage legislation or what have you. And they were saying, oh, my gosh, you all are homophobic. You won't support gay rights. This is the new wave of civil rights. In California in 2008, when they had Proposition 208 and gay marriage failed, they exclusively blamed black people, and this was just as widespread. This was in the Washington Post and many other articles where they highlighted and said, oh, my gosh, a disproportionate number of black people didn't support this. It's black people's fault that gay marriage failed in California. Even when gay marriage legislation passed in the Supreme Court last year, I saw lots of articles that were exclusively focused on Justice Clarence
Thomas.
Can I
jump in and just say, you know, not to you, but to this baloney, I mean, seriously, what I think is probably there, Gus, is that some of the same, you might have seen some of the same impulses that were driving a Pat Robertson or a Trent Lott, you might have seen among some, fundamentalist Christians who have a strict interpretation of the Bible, an extremely fundamentalist interpretation that somehow homosexuality is viewed as a sin, but for there to be, you know, articles suggesting that somehow blacks are getting in the way of gay civil rights, that's what I say baloney to.
I just want to make sure, have you seen this? Is this just something that I'm seeing where it's black people
No, I saw a little bit of it, Gus, but I could certainly say that, you know, I've heard a little bit about it, and, you know, I'll give you an example. It's more than a couple of years ago, this was the year that Barack Obama was running for president, and I was up in New England, and I was at a gay bar one day, and you know, the area around Boston, not necessarily elsewhere in New England, but Boston, it's a culturally conservative town, but the people there really pride themselves on being politically liberal, okay? And I was out with some Bostonians, and I was really shocked. I heard from two different people, I mean, it was unmitigated racism directed at the Obamas, okay? And, you know, regardless of their politics and everything else, it was just, they conveyed a sense of, you know, that somehow that it was offensive to them that a black man could become the president of the United States and heard these really kind of snarky, racist remarks about Michelle Obama. So, again, this is apart from whatever I may think about Obama's politics now, you know, after being 8 years in office, but it was clearly, to me, a racist perception. It really, you know, it was there. So I guess what I'm saying is it would not surprise me that some so-called liberals, okay, would have tried to, pass some of the blame on to or spread blame on black people for holding back the civil rights of gay people. Mm. I mean, this is one of the things in our culture is the blame aspect is, you know, it's like we don't want to sit down and really analyze and look at things in their complexities and understand root causes. It's the blame game. We want to quickly come up with some facile answer that, and I think when we do that, I do think it happens often around racism, you know, and I can say, you know, as someone who is of mixed race, I've certainly seen this since those early days of childhood growing up in Brooklyn, where I was the focus, you know, really was the focus of prejudice and bigotry, et cetera, and just really for being different, because if you think of it, it's really a double whammy. I mean, in those days, those kids didn't even know in my neighborhood that I had black blood in me. but I had a Hispanic last name, and they were all Irish Catholic. And then I'm sure by the time, you know, I'm 12, 13, 14 years old, it's also then obvious that I'm probably gay. So it's a double whammy. But could you imagine if they also knew that I had black blood? That would have been a triple whammy.
There, we had a person dialed in and had a question. I just, before I got their call, I wanted to, because I think she's, I think this is an important aspect of the story, even though Cindy Dixon is not a, like, main character in the story. I thought it was especially interesting once I got to the end of the book and you revealed more information about who she was and how this might be connected to Matthew Shepard's death. Just for our listeners, who is Cindy Dixon and is what happened to her, is that related to Matthew Shepard's death?
Well, Cindy Dixon was Russell Henderson's mother, his biological mother, and this crime against Matthew Shepard happened in early October of 1998. In January of 1999, just a few months later, while Russell Henderson was in prison awaiting trial for Matthew's murder, his mother was picked up by a man in Laramie. It was a freezing cold night. Outside town to a remote area about 8.5 miles from town called Rogers Canyon. He raped her in the car and pushed her out of the car and left the scene, and she froze to death by the side of the road. The man who did this was a convicted felon. He was also out on parole from another state then, so he was actually violating parole, and he fled the scene. So her body, she was found, and eventually the perpetrator was identified, and he was arrested, and he was actually charged with murder. Eventually, the authorities allowed him to plead guilty to manslaughter, and he got a 4 to 9 year prison sentence, and he was out in 4 years. And, you know, in the book, what I'm suggesting is that the degree of his involvement in bringing about Cindy Dixon's death there were definite parallels between the role that Russell Henderson played in Matthew Shepard's death, that Russell Henderson is not the person that beat Matthew, it was Aaron McKinney. And that it was, to me, interesting to say the least, that Russell Henderson got two life sentences, two consecutive life sentences, which means no possibility of parole, and yet this other fellow was out in 4 years.
In the book, unless I read incorrectly, you even suggest that the timing of this incident, Russell Henderson's mother being raped and killed, may have even been a warning to Russell Henderson that make sure you don't say anything that you are not supposed to say, since you, I think one of the main theories of the book is that there was a lot of drug activity, and that could have been what happened. Maybe Matthew Shepard knew something that he wasn't supposed to know, that maybe he too may have snitched, and so he had to be silenced in some way, that this could have been a warning.
Well, what I can say is that one law enforcement source and actually another source who are completely convinced that the killing of Cindy Dixon was connected to Matthew Shepard's murder, and that in addition to an attempt to silence Russell, that it also had to do with an ongoing rivalry between a couple of drug factions, that you had at the time of Matthew's murder, that there was a faction of people who were Denver-based who were moving product in Laramie, and then there were also people in Laramie directly who were moving product. And, you know, the drug business is a business that changes all the time. There were times when the bulk of the methamphetamine coming to Laramie would come from California and was driven from the west in an eastern direction. There were times when, the meth was coming from Casper in Wyoming. There were times when it was coming from, from the south up, from New Mexico through Colorado and then on up to Wyoming. So the routes were constantly shifting, and as you know, very similar to in Mexico, where you have different cartels, there were different, you know, rival factions in the meth business. And, you know, it happens that the group that Aaron McKinney was involved with was competitive with the group that Matthew Shepard was involved with.
Great passage in the book. Before I get our caller, where you write, this is Elaine Baker. She's giving her assessment on what happened to Cindy Dixon and kind of juxtaposing that with the convictions in Matthew Shepard's case. She says, where's the justice in this? Menifee, this is the killer of Cindy Dixon, rapist and killer, is a grown man that took a woman out, raped her, threw her out in freezing weather, naked, and allowed her to stay out there and die a slow, torturous death. That must have been awful to freeze to death. And then you have these young kids, Aaron and Russell, that are barely old enough to be in a bar on drugs, drugs controlling their whole lives, and they end up killing Matthew, and they're in prison forever and can't never get out. But this guy deliberately took Cindy Dixon up there to Rogers Canyon and raped her and killed her, spent 4 years in prison. What's wrong with this picture? Indeed.
Yeah, she was Elaine, an amazing source and a really brave woman. I will tell you that, because I first started talking with her back in 2004, and she knew Matthew Shepard and knew Aaron McKinney. And you know, for your listeners, you know, she describes the limousine driver and other people, so she knew them. And you know, she was very brave to be one of the people that was willing to come forward to talk about the fact that Aaron McKinney and Matthew were not strangers, that they knew each other and how they knew each other. You know, she was also, I'll just say, someone who watched a lot of the young people in that town get caught up with methamphetamine. I mean, you know, she saw it, you know, with a couple of her own kids, with her kids' friends, and it became a very, very serious problem. At the time this crime was going on, and for a few years after it, you know, Wyoming had the largest, you know, per capita rate of addiction and meth use in the country. So I think Elaine is in part speaking to that, and what she's saying is, you know, really, where is the justice that the life of this one woman, okay, Cindy Dixon, appeared, you know, from the judgments that were made in a court of law, it appeared as if her life was worth far less than Matthew Shepard's life was.
For sure, for sure. Mr. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Stephen Jimenez? You should be with us, sir. Do you have a question?
Is the guest, Mr. Jimenez, I guess I can ask you directly, are you, would you consider yourself to be a white person?
Well, that's a good question, you know. You know, the categories we've often had to describe ourselves, right, you know, they've changed over time. But if you look at me physically, I look more white than I look either black or to be a person of color. But I'm telling you, as a matter of fact, you know, that you go back a couple of generations in my family. My father's mother, my grandmother, was from the Dominican Republic, and she had definitely had black blood. And so am I describing myself inaccurately? I can certainly say...
I could cut to the chase. What's on your driver's license, sir? Is it white, black, or...
You know, I don't even know if my driver's license has my race, but I'll take a look while we're talking on the phone. Let me look. Let's see. I didn't even know that I had a race, and so this might be really instructive. You know what? It doesn't have race. Now, I'm going to tell you something. My driver's license is in New Mexico, okay? And there are a lot of Hispanics there. So that may be a reason, but it just has my sex, my weight, my height, and my eyes. But there's nothing here about race on my driver's license. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
If you went on a job interview, sir, what would you put down as your race?
You know, I used to put down white, but if I did it now, I'd probably put down Hispanic or other.
Has a black person ever accused you of practicing racism before?
No.
How about a Latino?
No. Not no. I haven't been accused. I haven't been accused of racism, but what I would say is, I think that it was something growing up that I wasn't even aware of about my grandmother until I was well into adulthood. It was not something that was talked about. However, I did learn that my grandmother in the 1930s, when my father and the whole family, there were eight kids, they traveled across country on a train from California, and they had to ride in the last car on the train because of the color of my grandmother's skin. So I never met her. She died before I was alive, but from pictures, you can see that she has African blood. That's very clear. But see, my background, I have more Spanish because I just have, you know, the African part is from my grandmother, is just from my father's, and then I also have a mixture of more from Spain, and then also I have some French and possibly even some Italian. So it would seem that my background is probably more Latino than it's African American, but there's certainly some African blood in me.
When you're around other white people, do they treat you like you are another white person, or do they treat you like you are a Latino?
They treat me like I'm another white person. Some, I would say in New York, people treat me more like another white person, but I have a tendency to really emphasize my mixed background. In New Mexico, I'd say as soon as people see my name, they identify with the fact that it's a Latino last name. Just depends on where I am.
My last question is, other than that time when you were in Boston,
yes,
and they were talking very negatively about the Obama family,
yes,
in a racist way, can you tell me any other times that you've heard white people that you've been around talking about black people in a racist way? Can you tell us some of the things that they said? I mute my line. Thank you.
God, that would take quite a cataloging, because I've certainly heard a lot of racial racial epithets and racial remarks, particularly growing up as a kid in New York, when New York City and Brooklyn, where I grew up, was much more racially segregated. I mean, you had neighborhoods that were very distinct, all white neighborhoods, all Irish neighborhoods, all Polish neighborhoods. But I will tell you this, I don't have much hair on my head anymore, but my hair was very curly and kind of bristly. And, one of the epithets that was, that was kind of used against me as a kid, okay, is some of the kids called me nigger knots because of my curly hair.
Fascinating. That is a new one. I'll have to add to the catalog. I had not heard that one before. I was curious myself in responding to some of Thomas in New York's questions. How do you know when you are being treated like a white person by other white people?
One of the things that I would say is I think it manifests in terms of class sometimes. You just feel it, and you can tell the difference when you're in social company and you're mixed, and it's racially mixed company, which typically I find that that's more likely to happen when I'm in a big city. I'm not going to say all the time, but usually when I'm in New York, it's usually a more mixed and diverse group of people. But I think it manifests itself more in terms of privilege and social class. I can certainly remember years growing up in New York where there was a presumption that the majority of crimes committed were being committed by black people. I mean, that's certainly a part of my memory.
Hmm. Now, have there ever been times when you've been around other white people and they make blatantly racist remarks or even veiled racist remarks about other black people and you're expected to co-sign, concur, just because they think that you are a white person? Has that ever happened?
Not recently, but I came to a place where if I heard a racist remark where it would come out, you know, if it would come out towards a black person or a Jew or Hispanic, because, you know, growing up with the Hispanic thing, the we were called spics when I was growing up. So that was another one that was used with me. When those things, have come up, I've generally just tried to say something, you know, not in a really defensive way, but just say, hey, you know, really that, you know, whatever it is, whether it's a statement that's made that, it offends me, just to say, you know, I find that really offensive that you say that. That feels racist to me. I may have attitudes myself that have been racist, but I'm hoping I can question them or be called on them, because I do think, you know, I was listening at the beginning of your show, and when I heard the phrase racism is our current reality, I found myself nodding to that and saying, boy, is it ever. I mean, and we see it manifesting, you know, it manifests at different times in different ways. But certainly we're seeing that right now in terms of all kinds of people from the Middle East. We have such a long, long history of that with black and African Americans, just, you know, of, you know, clear, you know, racial bias in everything, not just how we're perceiving crimes, but so many other things. Have things gotten a little bit better? But I agree with that notion of racism is our current reality. I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's true even with Obama as president.
Last few months of that. Won't be able to say that anymore at the beginning of the year.
Oh, Jesus. What the choices we're facing right now, Jesus. I mean, I don't think we have faced a period like this, not even like this, because 1968 wasn't like it, but in terms of not knowing what's going on from one day to the next. I mean, I'm fascinated by this. I mean, is Hillary Clinton going to get indicted?
I was going to comment, but I wanted to make sure I got another person that dialed in. The caller at 5640, did you have a comment for Mr. Jimenez? You should be with us as well, Mr. Person at 5640.
Yes, good evening. I have a question for Mr. Jimenez. Do you identify more so as a Latin, I don't know, like with having a Latin identity, or do you identify with other mixed race / biracials, including, but those that look have more of a white appearance, like yourself, like Mariah Carey? I can't think of any other mixed race individuals, but which side do you identify more so with?
Well, I identify as being a person of mixed racial background. It's kind of a joke. I mean, if you talk to any number of white people, they all think that they can trace their ancestry back to the Mayflower, and it's kind of a joke. I always think, my God, there had to be an awful lot of Mayflowers or a lot of space on the boat to accommodate all the people to think that they trace their roots back there. I mean, I think that there has been a stigma of shame. I think there are many more people of mixed racial background in this country than people have been willing to admit even today. I mean, look at how long it took, you know, around Thomas Jefferson to for any acknowledgement there. It was considered a secret that was, you know, it was a well-kept secret. But I think there's still a lot of that today, you know, and I think this applies to some Indian Native American, that you have a lot of mixed blood of people that identify as white when they have mixed blood, but they don't say that. I met a fellow recently who told me that I didn't know it because I was talking with him. He just looked white. He was from Montana, but he told me that he was of mixed blood, that he had ancestors from the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. And, you know, by looking at him or just by sitting and talking, I wouldn't have known it unless he acknowledged to me that he was of a racially mixed background.
And are you aware of the, for lack of a better term, hatred that a lot of Hispanics have towards blacks? And have you ever participated in, like, mistreating of people that have visible African blood or
no? I have not participated in any way with you know, any kind of hostility towards African Americans, and I am aware of it, and I would say that I have limited awareness of it, and I'll tell you what I mean by that is that because I've worked on crime stories for a number of years and have worked on justice stories, I've been more aware of it in terms of you know, incarcerated people. Usually incarcerated males, where you know, there has been real strife in certain prisons between African Americans and you know, whether it's I'm going to say Latino. I think many of them are Mexican or Mexican Americans, I should say, but I think there are also other Central American, you know, other Central Americans, whether they're, you know, from Honduras or Salvadoran or whatever. So I think it's mixed. But no, I you know, where I've spent a lot of time, even though I grew up in New York City, over the last 14 years, I've lived a good part of the time in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the tension there has been between the Hispanics and the native peoples, you know, the Indians, Native Americans. So less aware of it between. Between blacks and Hispanics, but no, among the Hispanic people, Latinos that I know, there has not really, I haven't experienced the hostility towards black people.
Okay. And then the last comment I wanted to make is, and maybe this is something that you can look up for further research, but I just want to give you some quick tidbits. Did you know that Abraham Lincoln himself was mixed race with black?
You know, and I had read or heard that, and that was very intriguing.
Yeah. One more thing. And did you also know that the indigenous people of this land were black? So you can look, you can do your research. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Last caller, the caller at 1536. 1536. Did you have a question for Mr. Jimenez? You should be with us.
Yes, thank you, Gus, and welcome to the guest. I was wondering if you could possibly go further into the racism which exists in the homosexual community, because if memory serves me correctly, several months ago I read an article about, I believe his name is Mike Sam, the gay player, football player, who was actually drafted by the St. Louis Rams, and he had made the statement that he experienced far more racism in the homosexual community than he did in the NFL, even though the NFL players he was playing with knew that he was homosexual. So I was wondering if you could go possibly more into that in the time you have left. Thanks very much.
Sure. I think that's a very, very interesting question. And of course, you know, I can't, since I haven't been in professional sports, it's hard for me to, you know, I can hear what you're saying, but it's hard for me to know it from inside his experience inside that world. I can tell you, though, about my experience, which is that I have noticed over time that in the gay community that there still is quite a bit of segregation. And it is something that has bothered me, that I've thought about, that I've observed. And again, I'm going to go back to something I said to Gus earlier, is that I also think there are class issues there. I think that, you know, let me articulate what I think could be a little bit of a racist perspective, for, you know, that you know, I'm going to express right now. And that is, it seemed, at least in the earlier days of the gay movement. You know, not I'm not talking about recently with, you know, gay marriage rights and all of that, but if we go back, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30 years, you know, that whole expression of people, of a gay black man being on the down low, that whole coding in terms of the gay social life was a way for, a black gay man to signal that he's gay, but he's on the down low, which, you know, is a form, really, I guess you could say, of being closeted. So the way I experience it is that if, for example, in New York City, if you, you know, you'll see some, you know, in some bars, you'll see some blacks and whites mixed, but you'll also go to some bars in New York that are predominantly where there are more blacks or more Hispanics, and then you'll go to bars that are more predominantly white. So I'm troubled by that. I'm troubled by the segregation that exists inside the gay community.
Did that answer your question, sir, caller?
It does a little bit, but I guess it doesn't give the kind of details that I was hoping to hear. I'm not specifically asking about the Mr. Sam's experiences. I was asking about his observations. I know he gave a little bit of those, but do you believe that there is that much more racism, I guess, in the homosexual community than is often propagated through the media or even understood by black people in general? Is it less intense, or is it more intense, I guess, is the question that I really would like an answer to.
Well, you know, I can't say that I've experienced more racism towards blacks in the gay community than is more evident in the society at large, okay? I'm just saying that in social settings, that there does appear to be some segregation there, okay? I can't say that it's greater than what exists in the larger society. I mean, you know, I think that if you go to, big American cities, you're going to see still that there can still be a good deal of segregation in terms of where people live in certain neighborhoods. And I, you know, I'm not in favor of that, but that certainly to me is still the case. I don't think in any way, you know, I think racism is still ever present right now.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Right on. Two quick questions I wanted to get in before we let you enjoy the rest of your 4th of July weekend. You referenced, and I'm asking this because we just had an author on the program Wednesday, and he did not widely refer to the people that he was discussing in his book on a first-name basis, but he did it in in specific references, which I thought was telling, but you, in a pretty general sense, refer to people on a first-name basis in the book. Why is that?
Well, I think that it was really what felt natural to me, in the sense that, remember, I was involved with this story for a long time, okay? And so in talking with these sources over a long period of time, and in some cases there are people that I did, you know, I spent a lot of time with in person, but there were also phone interviews, and there were emails, and there were phone calls, is that this was, you know, this was the nature of the conversations that I had with them. You know, they weren't calling me Mr. Jimenez. If it was Matthew's friend Tina LaBrie, I was calling her Tina, and she was calling me Steve, not Mr. Jimenez. So when I reproduced it in the book, I wanted to reproduce it with a kind of immediacy, and I'm going to say even intimacy, which is how I experienced it. Because in the cases of many of these sources, I really needed to spend time with them before they would really open up and go beyond maybe what they had told a newspaper reporter, or if they had never spoken before. For them to open up and really talk to me, it took some time for that to happen. But once it did happen, you know, that's the basis it was on. I'm not saying all of these people were my friends, but, you know, this the way the story unfolded to me over a long period of time, there was a kind of sustained connection with people that I wanted the book to reflect.
Right on, right on. I'm just pointing out for listeners, because like I said, this came up just days ago with a different author. In my view, at least, major difference. It was not widespread in your book. It's pretty widespread in terms of you referring to these people on a first-name basis. It's not isolated to just one or two people, which was not the case for the previous author that we had on the program. It was just central to one or two people. People he had never met, by the way, people that were deceased and were significantly older than him, which I also thought was significant and, in my view, incorrect what was happening. But this is significantly different in terms of what you're doing in your book on the first name basis. But appreciate that. The last, as I said at the very beginning of the program, the whole reason that I was reminded of the book of Matt, your work, was because Matthew Shepard was mentioned in reports where they were talking about the shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. It just happened a few weeks ago. Approximately 49 people killed and many more than that injured. And it was a lot of the same commentary, war on gays, I can't believe this happened. And as I stated at the beginning, even more details are coming out now. I'm sure by the end of the year there'll be a lot more details about what happened. But I know within the last, I think, 2 weeks, they had a report. It was on Color Lines and many other outlets I saw that reported this, where they had someone who alleged to be a former friend who had sexual intercourse with Omar Mateen. I think the term he used specifically was friends with benefits, was how he characterized it.
Right.
And he said that he was upset. Omar Mateen was upset. He went and did this act at this at the Pulse nightclub because he, I guess, was attracted to quote unquote Latino males. And he felt that they had used him. He felt that even one of them might have been HIV positive, and he might have contracted that. But he was upset at how he had been misused by them. He felt, even though he had some sort of sexual attraction there, and that was why he carried this out. I've heard lots of reports where they said that this is a hate crime, and a lot of the reporting just has been, it has been interesting and at times very conflicting about things that have been said about this incident, and it's still early. Just what are your views? Is this a hate crime based on what you've seen thus far?
Well, you know, Gus, it's fascinating because, you know, as soon as I heard the first reports about Orlando, immediately I started to observe the way it was being reporting. So I was sampling, getting the news from a bunch of different places. I would pull up, you know, different news organizations' websites, and I was just really looking at it from a variety of perspectives. And I have to say that from the very beginning, I had a lot of questions. I suppose it's because of my work on the Shepard story, but I was not ready to accept anything I was being told until I knew that people, journalists and investigators, were really looking at this and were giving hard information. Because I think what happens is opinion substitutes very quickly for hard information. I was very interested in knowing more about Omar Mateen's background, how long he had lived there, where he had worked, and a lot of that information that was coming up, it was suggesting a more complicated narrative. So I was interested when I heard that Mateen had been going to the club for 3 years. I was very intrigued by that, but not completely surprised because, you know, when initially the word was that the implications were this attack in this nightclub was either a blatant act of anti-American terrorism or it was a blatant act of anti-gay hatred. And I was not accepting either one of those as being completely true. I felt like, you know, there's a more complicated set of facts. What is it? Now, again, if Omar Mateen, was bisexual or he was having these sexual activities, what really were the motives here and what was behind it? And I think it takes time to really look at those facts, and I can't tell you. I mean, I don't have the information. I haven't researched it. I can't tell you whether this was a hate crime or not. But I can tell you, in the first reports, a rush to judgment to say that it was a hate crime before real facts have been gathered, that's troubling to me. The other thing that I noticed is even though the early news reports in the first few days mentioned that people were there for Latin night, they didn't mention that more than two-thirds of the victims were actually Latino. They didn't say that. They just made it like, you know, people were massacred at this gay club. And the way I learned that is I went to a vigil. I believe it was the first or second day after this happened. And at the vigil, already 48 of the 49 victims, they had names that were associated with them. So they read a list of the names. And I was really stunned that, you know, you were hearing a lot of Latino names among the victims. Which is different than the fact that people were going to a bar for Latin night, because that's different. So I'm very interested in learning more about the case and what happened there, but I would not do a rush to judgment saying it was a hate crime, nor would I do that and say it was an act of terrorism in the way that we understand terrorism, as far as, you know, related to ISIS or something else. If I could make one final comment, I noticed in one of the early reports on CNN that Wolf Blitzer interviewed Marco Rubio, the former senator from Florida, and Marco Rubio immediately started to talk about the politics of us, you know, we need more security in the country, and kind of advancing more of the national security state agenda. And I was kind of shocked not to hear Marco Rubio mention anything about the victims or the families of the victims, but immediately politicizing it. So I just don't want to be part of politicizing a mass murder like that before we have all the facts.
Right on. As I said, when I heard this and they mentioned Matthew Shepard, that was why I read your book, but a lot of that sounds very similar to what happened in Wyoming in 1998, where, if I can even use your terminology, the gay mobilization happened very quickly before we even had a lot of accurate information about exactly what happened. It was off and running, and still off and running. That's still the way people talk about this, and I suspect that's going to be it for a long time. You even mentioned a lot of the efforts to discredit your work. I read quite a few of those online as well. I was glad you brought that out as well, that these folks have been unwilling to debate you about the merits of the material that you presented in the book. If they have a problem with what you wrote or want to challenge you directly on anything, they have been unwilling thus far. I guess the only thing I will say is get back to Wyoming and do that book on Mr. Kevin Robinson, because I would very much like to read that and hear from him directly. I would, if we're talking racism, white supremacy, it sounds like there might be many victims in Wyoming. I think Kevin Robinson deserves a few more pages if you have time for that, sir.
He does, and that's why I was meeting with him last week, because at the time I met him, Gus, I was already deep into the work on Shepard. But I just have to say how much I appreciate your invitation to come on your show. I really was very interested in the comments of your listeners, and I'm so glad that you have this forum, because I think it's talking about issues that are really they're underexplored in the mainstream culture, and I think we really need to be addressing these things more. So I really thank you for having me as a guest.
Oh, pleasure was ours. It was great. I'm glad I read your book. I feel like I learned quite a bit, and I know some of our listeners, they did as well in preparing for you to come on the program. That book, again, The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths, about the murder of Matthew Shepard, our guest, Mr. Stephen Jimenez. And you can look forward to it. Kevin Robinson Project is coming. Put some peer pressure on him to see if he can get
that. If any of your listeners have any further comments or any further reflections, if they share them with you and you share them with me, or we have a Facebook page, facebook.com/bookofmatt, I'd love to hear from anyone else about the book, and thank you again.
Oh, for sure. We'll link that in the description, and if anybody has any questions for Mr. Jimenez, if you're listening to the archive, I will email them along. I'm pretty sure he will follow up and get back to you.
Thanks so much, Gus.
for sure. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, holiday, and all that good stuff. And we will be in touch, sir.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, sir. Take care. Context of white supremacy. Fascinating. Fascinating. This is definitely one of those. I remember Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, where she has she recommended, I think someone called in. They were asking specifically for books to read, things that she would encourage us to check out. And she said, just read all the time. Read, read, read. There's so many books out. And she frequently did. She mentioned a ton of books over the years, over her many visits on the program. She mentioned many, many books. We're going to be doing some in the book club as we go to make sure that we keep her teachings alive and are following up, appreciating the work that she did over the years. But she just said, read, man, read, read, read. Even her sister said that she has so many books in her house and encouraged reading. Just read. There's so much information out there. I am so glad I read this book because, as I said, I accepted what they said about Matthew Shepard, that this was a hate crime. He was killed because he was gay, and that's just what it was. This was terrible. Yes, it is terrible, but just digging a little bit further, there does not seem to be any evidence that he was killed because he was gay. It is fascinating all the way through. And the metaphors, I say that so consistently on the program, the metaphors, I am glad that we got a clean answer in response to when the Clinton administration and others saying that, hey, tread lightly, Matthew Shepard's murder is our, meaning the gay community's, Emmett Till. Him saying that that is not factual at all. He used a lot of the exact same reasoning and logic that I give in terms of why we should be very, very careful when we employ metaphors to speak about racism, white supremacy, and when others, white or non-white, are talking about racism, because frequently the metaphors are not accurate. They're employing all sorts of nonsense. And I think this happens a lot, particularly when it's anything that is related to white gays. There ends up being a lot of rhetoric and hyperbole. And I mean, really, you don't even have to be highfalutin. You can call it what it is. It's just lies and dishonesty that gets promoted. And just that right there is blatant. And he didn't answer the question I asked him three times about if Matthew Shepard's name should even be there. I thought that was important, too, because I have no hesitation. His name should not even be there. I'm not saying it's just what happened to it. I'm what happened to Mr. Shepard. I'm not condoning it at all. But it was not a hate crime. He was not killed because he was gay. Make sure that we're being accurate. If you want to make some sort of policy or a campaign around methamphetamine use and drug use and make Matthew Shepard the poster child for that and saying why this is wrong because this is the type of thing that can happen, great. That would be much needed. But to have his and have his name first, Mr. Jimenez got to that before I even asked him. His name is first. If you look up the official title of that hate crime legislation that was ultimately signed by President Obama, even though it was started when Clinton was in office, it is the Matthew Shepard, James Byrd Jr. hate crime bill. That in and of itself shows the power of racism, white supremacy. We can take someone who was not even a victim of a quote-unquote hate crime, and it will be eponymously named for them. If folks have commentary that they would like to share based on what they heard during the broadcast or what they heard about the case, I would be curious, just anybody out there, if had information about that, if folks out there thought that Matthew Shepard in 98 was killed because he was gay, if, you know, this was new information or a perspective people had not heard before, if they just accepted what had been said in the news repeatedly, that would be interesting to hear. But certainly if you have other comments on what you heard during the broadcast, I have a photograph of Mr. Jimenez on my Facebook page, so you can see what he looks like. I know racial classification, that became a significant aspect of the dialogue. I know it was for me even before we did the program, just trying to ascertain his racial classification. But there's a photograph of him. I almost even thought it would be important to share multiple photographs because he doesn't look quite the same. I think I've heard Mr. Fuller talk about this, where the lighting can shift sometimes, or if you catch someone, if it's summertime and they've had a tan or anything like that, that they might look a little different depending on when they're photographed and what have you. But you can check out and at least see one image of what he looks like on the Facebook page. And if you have any comments on that, we can get that in as well. Anywho, quick audio segment. This is Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. Giving commentary. This is from a while ago. I don't even remember. This is from a while back when Mr. Fuller was on the program and he was giving some of his thoughts on how the gay mobilization, as he termed it in the book, how that has been used. And his view, just to add a lot of confusion, particularly the way that black people think about racism, white supremacy, and trying to conflate these issues. We'll get that in, and then if anybody has commentary, we will get to that as well. Context of white supremacy.
Yeah, I've been seeing a whole lot of those reports of that's the new direction that the NAACP is supposed to be heading.
Well, I haven't heard that report until now, and if that is the DRA report, that's a sorry state of affairs. And, hey, nothing I can say in support of that at all. I mean, that is not the way to go by no measure. But see, most black people, you know, have been, because they know so many people who are like that, they don't know which way to go with it. They say, well, that does make sense. I mean, they are human beings and whatnot. But they should look at it within the context of, is this a problem among black people? Or is this something that's thought up by the white supremacists, which I claim that it is? And I say, no, this is strictly right from the root. This came out of the mind of a white supremacist, this whole mess, and that is aimed at non-white people globally. See what I mean? That's who it's aimed at, that whole movement. All of it. See, but they make it, you know, naturally they have the so-called white gaze out there, but more and more, you're seeing, hey, they don't even want to have a parade or nothing like that unless they got plenty of black people involved. They recruit black people deliberately. They don't hardly recruit black people for nothing that's worthwhile. But they'll come and get you to help lead the gay rights movement. How come they don't come and get black people to help lead something that's going to really be of help? Like get a better roof over your head, you know, or more money or something like that. You don't see them beating the bushes doing that. Coming knocking on your black person's door and saying, I'm trying to figure out a way, you know, I came here to help you triple your salary. How many white people you see doing that? But you'll have four or five of them standing on your porch. I come to help you support the gay rights movement. In fact, you could be the leader. You can be the spokesperson. We prefer you to be that. But how many white people come and knock on a black person's door and said, you know, we are here as the committee, and we have been burning mid-door trying to figure out a way that we can quadruple your salary on your job, and we want to sit down and talk to you about it. Now we're getting somewhere. But you knocking on my door with a bunch of pamphlets and whatnot talking about help some gay right movement, and you don't come and knock on my door for anything else, ever? Now, that should make me suspicious right there. What's supposed to be the benefit? Oh, well, I mean, it's all in the interest of freedom and recognizing human beings for what they are, human beings. No, no, no. Y'all got another agenda here. No, no, no. What I need is you to go downtown and tell them people to stop foreclosing on me. That's what I need. Get a committee for that. Right. Yeah.
How do you codify dealing with that so that, you know, it doesn't sound like
you tell them just like I'm saying it. I'm saying when it comes to something that's really pressing on people's minds and all like that, we have to run up and down the street trying to find you. But you will come and knock on my door at midnight with a committee saying lead the gay rights movement. And I'm fixing to get foreclosed on. I mean, where are your priorities? Because I know what mine are. You're not even asking me. You're introducing a whole bunch of nonsense to me. No, absolutely not. You got another agenda. And I don't think it's healthy for me to accept you coming to me with this. You're going to turn the NAACP, I mean, you know, with all the things, every type of problem that black people have all over this world, and you're going to make that the top of the agenda? That's going to be the number one thing that you are centering on? We would have to be something wrong with our minds to make that a priority. Even if you're going to put it on the list at all, that's way down on the list with us. It may be on the top of the list for you, because you ain't got nothing else to do. You know? Evidently, you don't have no problems. We got problems. You're talking about some gay parade. We don't have no time for that. We don't have no time for no parading at all.
I agree. I wish, you know.
I'm just talking about using this plain, you don't even have to call it basic logic. Just plain old country common sense. That's country road common sense. You know, that's wagon trail common sense. But that's what they're pushing and saying that we should make it a priority in the schools. And you got a person sitting up there that can't even read and write. Got a whole classroom full of students. I mean, you know, half of them can't read and all like that. This is the ninth grade. And you going to make this a priority? I mean, even a drunk person could see through that. That's the way I see it, and I think it's right on point, too.
Context of White Supremacy, producejustice.com. You can check out Mr. Fuller's material, what he has to say, get books, the code book or the word guide, whatever the case may be, producejustice.com. Country logic, that is a new one on Gus T. Anywho, I think that's great to add. We heard the word context a lot today. That's always grand on the program, in my opinion. But yeah, I always think that is a great context to keep things in. And I think particularly for people attempt to counter racists who study racism, white supremacy, and why there is sizable pushback around the way that, quote unquote, gay rights or LGBTQ issues are talked about. At least for me, this program, major aspect of why I think that's significant and why there should be a lot of questions anytime that comes up or there's any sort of comparison to racism, white supremacy. I think I'm going to have to get that cover that was in Time magazine where it said the war, the war on gays. That was from 98 when Matthew Shepard was killed, because that is, it's common rhetoric in terms of talking about racism, white supremacy. Before I get to any of the callers, if folks had anything they wanted to share, since Boston was mentioned, every time that I hear Boston mentioned, I think of Charles Stewart, the white male race soldier. He killed his pregnant wife, since we're talking about killing pregnant females and having some sort of reticence about that, of being outraged about that, killed his pregnant wife, white wife, and then blamed it on a Negro, and they ran amok in Boston, ransacking different residences of black people and saying, you know, oh my goodness, I can't believe that you all did this, and snatch up any black person who fit the description, what have you. This one went on for a long time before they find out that this white guy made up the whole thing, lied, and then he committed suicide as his deception began to unravel. That's one. And then also, when I think of Boston, when people try and pass that malarkey off on me as though New England or any spot on the planet is quote-unquote liberal, not racist, less racist, whatever that means. I think of Ted Landsmark, the black male who was speared by the American flag since his 4th of July in the 1970s, not 19th century, not 18th century. 1970s was speared because whites didn't want little Negro children going to school with their white children, and so they threw a fit and started assaulting black people. This was in Boston, not Mississippi or Georgia. Those are the first two things that I think of when I think of Boston. Anywho, just great information, as I said, in reading the book. I did think it was interesting that he could not answer cleanly whether or not Matthew Shepard's name should be removed from the hate crime bill. That I thought was very significant. His photograph, I said it's on the Facebook page if folks are interested in checking that out. I did have the audio clip of Bill Clinton talking about this at the beginning. I also think it's significant, Bill Clinton being such a conniving, maniacal white man, and the many times that his name has come up on the program this year, you would think he's running for office. But Mr. Jimenez, in his book, he points out that Bill Clinton was doing a lot of this gesturing and pandering about Matthew Shepard and, oh, this is terrible and American values and blah, blah, blah. He was doing all that. This was right when the whole Monica Lewinsky thing was about to break, right in the middle of him being impeached, that he was making a big to-do about this. So he suggests that this could have been a political act that to curry some favor with the gay movement and other people to get them to kind of rally around and not focus so much attention on me. I'm about to be impeached and all of my sexual misdeeds. Let's focus on this sex crime over here where Matthew Shepard has been brutally murdered. Also thought it was significant them lying and saying that he was crucified, which was not the case. They also said that they had took cigarettes and burned him. That also was not true as well. They just master job of deception on this case. That's why I would say this book is significant for me. At least I'm glad I was able to read it. Any of the folks listening in have commentary they wanted to add? If you had a hand up, line should be open. As I said, I would be curious if anybody, people who just accepted the narrative, because I sure did, accepted that Matthew Shepard was killed because he was gay and that's what it was, and never had a second thought. If folks had any comments on that, or specifically what they heard from the guest, anything stood out, if he didn't answer a question or anything that you thought needs to be emphasized, feel free.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
So given that the interview took place and we've listened to him, I just wanted to ask, do you think he's a white man or he functions as a white man, or do you think he's like mixed race? Because he just seems white to me, despite his back. I mean, I know his background, but I wanted to ask you. Thank you.
I saw several different photos I touched on. I saw one where he looked a little bit darker. And I thought, oh, yeah, white people are not going. Based on that photograph, I said, I don't think a sizable number of white people would accept him as white based on that photograph. And then with his name being Jimenez. Then I saw some other photographs where he did not look that dark. I don't know if he had a tan. That's why I said it. If you're seeing a photograph, it could be the lighting. It could be they had a tan. It could be a lot of different factors. It could have been photoshopped. Who knows? But I saw some other photographs where he just looked like a white person. Where I was like, wait a minute, now I'm not sure. So I've said this before, anybody that is ambiguous, it's not clear, I can't get a clean answer to the question, I just say that they are in the racist suspect category. That way I don't get fooled. I just have to function that this person I suspect of being a racist because I'm not clear about their racial classification, or if I see them and I'm not sure, if I see different photographs and sometimes they look like they might be a white person, sometimes they might be a non-white person. I've unfortunately had that happen before as well. Whites do the classifying. So for him and other folks where there's any sort of racial ambiguity where I'm not 100% sure, I just put them in the racist suspect category and leave it at that.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, that was very enlightening. And actually, I remember when the story on Matthew Shepard broke. And I was a bit young, but it didn't, to me, it didn't register as anything but, okay, this was a guy who died. I couldn't really figure out why it was such a big deal, why it was gaining national coverage, because truthfully, I lived about an hour away from a major city, and, you know, on a summer's day, in a summer's week, we probably had 5 to 7 black people who were getting killed, and national media, heck, local media didn't even care. So it wasn't anything really, it didn't stand out to me in any way. But on the homosexual front, I find it interesting presently that there is so much push to grant homosexuals, quote, civil rights when, as I pointed out to a friend a couple of months ago, a lot of them had these civil rights. The only difference was they just couldn't say that they were gay. So for me, the fact that a lot of them keep saying that there's a connection between black civil rights struggle and their civil rights struggle is just ludicrous and absurd. I would like to suggest to the listeners a book that I found called Dating Habits of Young Black Americans and Almost Everybody Else Too. This is a book, I don't believe it's in print anymore, from 1979, but I was able to find a used copy on Amazon.com. And on page 75, there's a interesting section, very brief, unfortunately, and there's a couple of books that suggested in the section, but it's on the black community and homosexuality. And what it says about that is that the author believed, well, the patterns in the black community stated that homosexuality was a white person's problem, and that when it began to creep into the black community, there was a feeling amongst the members, at least so far as research can tell, that the individuals who were demonstrating that habit had picked it up from white people. Now, this was many decades ago. However, as it began to increase more and more and more, particularly during the 60s and 70s, researchers suggested, particularly psychologists suggested, that it was because the masculinity of the men and the femininity of the women were being mingled by the societal norms. And what everyone thinks about it, I'm not saying I agree with it, I'm not saying that I don't, but there are some interesting suggested case studies that they point to here. I have yet to read them. I'm getting the books actually this month. So just something to kind of keep in the back of your mind and maybe do some further research on. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Sure, folks, we'll check that one out. If anyone reads it, share if you have any thoughts. Or maybe you can even do a book review. That's something I would encourage. Reading and writing. One of our listeners added that in. Reading and writing. Extremely important in our counter-racist endeavors. So, and that's even something I'm trying to get better about myself. I realized that I had to read a lot of books that, you know, I could write 2 paragraphs and just do a review. More of the books that I read that might encourage more people to read, and that pops up when people do searches of the book, that you get to insert your opinion. If you read a book that's by a racist, a suspected racist, then you can point out some of the things that they did in the book that might have been the practice of white supremacy. Or if you read something that's great material by a non-white person, black author, and you want to support black writers, hey, write a review. That will help promote their work and maybe encourage more folks to buy their product and read what they have to say. So write reviews if you read books. I'm talking to Gus T. Renegade first and foremost. Anybody else dialed in with a hand up, have commentary they wanted to get in?
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I apologize. I missed the bulk of the interview. I kind of came in right before you chimed in to ask questions. I do, however, from what I know, usually Spanish person, someone who speaks Spanish, they're very quick to tell you, have a lot of pride in where they're from. And when someone starts dilly-dallying and beating around the bush, I kind of suspect that they can function as a white person, and they also can function as a non-white person at times, you know, whatever benefits them. So I definitely think so. And just another tidbit, also what President Bill Clinton did to direct attention, divert attention away from that whole Monica Lewinsky scandal, was he created the myth, the legend Osama bin Laden, when he shot that missile into a tent in the middle of the desert, and kind of, you know, came up with this whole story of this this terrorist that they were trying to target. So, you know, Bill Clinton, Pat Thiel and Bill, and I'll meet my line. Thank you.
What'd you call him? What did you say? Something Bill? What did you say?
Oh, Pat Thiel and Bill.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right on. Right on.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys, to Thomas in New York, Dave, and all the other callers. I just wanted to say I missed the vast majority of the interview. That's why I didn't have many questions. I was just doing some things with the family as far as working with my in-laws, helping my wife with them. And then I wasn't sure if the show was on because I've been checking the site all day, and I didn't actually realize it until way after it already started. But I was going to say when the whole incident happened with Matthew Shepard originally, I like the caller before Thomas, felt the same way. Like, I didn't understand why it was such a major situation as far as what took place. And I felt that it was patently incorrect at that time to associate Matthew Shepard with James Byrd. I felt that that was, like, literally the origin of what we're dealing with today. I think that was one of the major pushes in the direction of normalizing homosexuality itself, and then associating the gay struggle with the black struggle, which I felt was patently incorrect way back then. And to me, what we're witnessing today, especially after the situation in Florida, kind of shows the progression. And I really think that the Matt Shepard incident was a major push to both normalize homosexuality and associate the homosexual struggle with the black struggle and tie the two in a way that had never been done before in history. I did get to look up some of his pictures. I saw different photographs of him, but to me, he looked white in all of the photographs. So I just found his take very interesting. I definitely want to read the text itself just to get more insight on the details. I was really sorry that I missed the whole interview, except for maybe the very, very tail end of it. But I just felt like that was just the first major push to facilitate things going in the direction that we've currently gotten to. Even when you look at the where hip-hop culture was in 1998 and forward, that was even when, to me, when the push started to move, and even in hip-hop culture, to normalize homosexuality. It was a few years later that I believe the first gay rapper came out. His name was Caution. And I remember there was a big hoopla about him coming out being openly gay. And there was a big deal. Again, the whole idea of black people being homosexual group, all of that came out around that time. So I just found it very fascinating, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the program during the, listen to the archives. Thank you very much for taking my call, Dustin.
For sure. That was, I delayed in posting the program because there have been enough instances over the years where people have stood us up at the last minute and been like, oh, these crazy niggas, the cows, what did I agree? I'm not, you know, going to talk to them. That's happened enough times, and he did not confirm with me. I had mailed him a few days back and hadn't heard back from him, but then he did this morning confirm that he was going to be visiting with us. So after that, I went ahead and posted the content, but it was significantly later than I normally do. We were going to broadcast either way. I was just going to come on and talk about some of the information in the book on how this relates to the gay rights division of white supremacy. I put that in context of what he writes in the book. But I was just waiting so that way I wouldn't have to do a whole lot of editing of the description and going back to changing things, because then I have to go to a lot of different sites and make all those changes and edit and all that. So I just want to be able to do it one time correctly and not have to go back and do five and six different alterations. But that was why it was late. If anybody was checking at Black Talk Radio or any of the other sites to see about the posting for today, it was posted very late.
You know, I thought that was actually what was going on. I totally was, like, forward thinking about that whole situation. That's exactly what I was thinking. And funny, you just made me think of something. I was watching the Hidden Colors 4 documentary recently, and they were talking about, in the documentary at one point, they talk about Jamaica, and Jamaica being such an intensely homophobic environment from what, you know, people generally say. And what they talked about was the history of Jamaica as a seasoning plantation where they did what they call buck breaking. And they said that part of the buck breaking process, a major part of it, was for them to take the most powerful black male, the strongest, the leader type black male, and rape him in front of all the other black people there in order to facilitate breaking him down and breaking the will of the black people who witnessed what happened to him. And they were saying that that was actually the origin of Jamaicans being so anti-homosexuality, was this witnessing repeatedly of this buck-breaking process, and that had such an intense imprint on the psyche of Jamaican people that that is where that developed from. And I remember I mentioned that previously, that maybe what they're calling homophobia is just us carrying in our DNA that remnant of watching our males being raped and our boys being raped on the slave ship and on the plantation. So I just wanted to toss that out there. Thank you.
Wow. Fascinating. Fascinating. Wow. Wow. Man, if folks had anything else they needed to make sure they got in before we wrap, you should do so now, because we pretty much have done our 3 hours. If you have anything else you need to get in, you should do so now, unless you are satisfied.
And yeah, I have a quick thing to get in, Gus, if I can. I missed the Saturday Corey show yesterday. I was my daughter went away for camp today for 2 weeks, and she wanted to go to the movies last night, so we took out, and we went to see The Purge. So I don't know if you saw it yet, but I didn't know if you were interested in hearing my commentary on it.
If you is it possible you can, I don't know, find a quieter nook that maybe we can reduce some of the background noise? Sounds like folks are having a jolly old time for the festivities this weekend. If you can find a quieter nook, maybe we can, so we can focus in and not have any disruption.
I turned the TV off now, so that's probably better.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the whole time of the movie, I just kept thinking of you. You know, what you always say, don't help white people. Don't help white people. And the black people kept helping the white people. They all ended up dying. And I just thought that was just so typical. How they, you know, they did the movie. And also, I think it was a lot of negative portrayal of black females, kind of making them seem as though they're, as Hillary put it, how did you coin black men? I forgot. They're like terroristic. I mean, that's how every black female in the movie, their portrayal was very aggressive, a murderer, a killer. It wasn't in a good picture, a good light at all. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Not surprised. Definitely.
I was thinking super predators. Super predators.
Yeah, definitely wouldn't hope other folks don't go and spend your hard-earned nickels to support The Purge. I'm sure it'll be available online within, if it's not already there, I'm sure it'll be there soon. I know the new Independence Day, I know that is online, and I wasn't even really looking for that, but I can't say that is online if folks are, you know, if you have a few minutes to waste or you are so inclined, that's another one you can save your money for already. It's already there. You can do whatever film study you need without having to support white supremacist cinema. I'm not surprised.
What site, Gus?
If you give me a second, once we go offline, I can send you the link. If you want to check it out for Independence Day, I'll email.
And I just wanted to add in, I didn't spend a dime.
Outstanding.
We had free movie test passes from her school, so we took all 5 of them and went.
Outstanding. Great job. That's another thing too, because you can, a lot of times you can find ways where you can get free passes and such like that. Outstanding. Great counter-racist effort. But, yeah, definitely. I have not seen it. I am going to check it out. We have folks who also seem like they do a pretty good job of finding films. If somebody, this one I don't really want to see I would prefer to see like a pristine copy, and they generally do get the pristine copies available pretty quickly, even for stuff that comes out in the theaters. So once a pristine HD copy is available, I will check it out and make an effort to write a review. But I know the folks who have it. Matter of fact, the review that I posted from Forbes.com, they said that the white supremacy was pretty explicit in this one, and I was surprised because I don't normally see them use the term white supremacy at Forbes.com, but that was in the review that they had on the front page of their site this week, so I thought it must be pretty. But I mean, the franchise itself is pretty explicit in my view. I mean, that was what the whole first movie was about, whites hunting and stalking to kill one unarmed black person who hadn't done anything to them. So, I mean, the franchise is pretty blatant, generally speaking.
Well, Gus, I must say that they all had on swastikas, all of the soldiers that were the government soldiers going to kill people, swastikas even on their faces, tattooed, the White Knight Force was on all their uniforms, like a patch, and it was explicitly talking about getting rid of the people who are less, you know, the society doesn't need. You're sick of paying for people. So, you know, this is the way we could get rid of them, which was very interesting.
That's pretty blatant. I think that was kind of what they were saying in the Forbes review that I read, that it was pretty blatant. They did not leave. You didn't have to work too hard to connect the dots, as Dr. Welsing would say, that they made it unambiguous what they were talking about, what they were promoting in this one. And they even connected it to Trump and Brexit and, you know, what's happening in real world in connection to this. So I definitely will make time to view it. Anybody, anything else they needed to make sure they got in before we wrap? Folks are satisfied? Grand. Did want to make sure that I included a retired firefighter in New York. He had messaged. I think within the last 7 days, the Stonewall site where they had the confrontation with individuals who classify themselves as gay. I think this happened in the 70s, unless my dates are off. He wrote and he said, homosexuals are bragging about their stand at Stonewall, which was identified as a historical site. In contrast, on 41st and Central, the Black Panther Party defended their office in 1969 against the police. Black self-respect behavior such as that is not encouraged under white supremacy. Absolutely. And I do think with the Stonewall situation that they were confronting enforcement officials, I cannot ever, under any circumstances, imagine a monument being erected to black people confronting enforcement officials. I just cannot imagine under any circumstances that being something that becomes a shrine, a memorial that we want to keep this treasured forever as citizens standing up to tyranny. Like, I could not imagine that happening in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with the MOVE situation or the Black Panther situation, any context. I could not imagine that happening anywhere in the world if that sort of thing went down, where black people were standing up to the police and we're not going to take you all pushing us around and beating us up anymore.
Hey, Gus, you know how you always talk about white supremacists planning like decades, sometimes hundreds of years in advance for how things are going to look down the road? And you made me think about when Dr. Umar talked about the initial move in the early 70s to change homosexuality from a mental illness and normalize it. And I think that at that time when they went in that direction, they basically were looking at where we are right now as far as the whole gay rights thing and the gay marriage and all of this stuff. I think what was the origin of all of that started then, and they were looking forward till now where we are living, and this is the way it is. And one of the things that I think facilitated that too, weirdly enough, from the Living Colors, Hidden Colors documentary, they interviewed Professor Anthony Browder, and he talked about, he lives in D.C., and he talked about a think tank that actually conferred with the State Department, and that this particular think tank actually basically plots white supremacy 200 years in advance, and they report to the State Department of the United States, and the State Department, based on their trajectory, basically orchestrates the different aspects of society to facilitate what their predictions are so that everything works out exactly the way that they plan. He said that they discussed where the rich people would be located, where the poor people would be located, how many of them would be alive at that time. I mean, all every detail possible. And once they get that trajectory, basically the State Department goes about enacting everything necessary to facilitate things ending up that way within that 200-year period. So everything that you have always talked about in reference to that is absolutely correct. And I think that this whole situation we're in now with the whole gay rights push and the connection of gay rights to the black liberation struggle started back then in the 70s, and they were looking forward, you know, 30, 40, 50 years to where we are now. Thank you.
The caller at 0748, did you have a comment you need to get in before we wrap up? Last four digits, 0748. Did you have a commentary? Don't know if they're just listening. It looked like they got a hand up. If you are just listening, that is fine. I thought your line should be open. I'll check one more time before we wrap things up, just to make sure they didn't miss out if they had something they wanted to get in before we conclude. We will be back, I think, Tuesday. I'm just having to double check. People had asked if I had spoken with Dr. Kamban. I did last week. I'm just trying to find time to get the audio segment included, where he gave some of his thoughts on Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing, a few other topics, where I asked him if I could play the segment on the program. So we'll get that in this week with Dr. Kamban. I think it'll be on Tuesday. Just check the Black Talk Radio Network. And or you can check the Facebook page and you'll get the exact time. It'll probably be the normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. But if you have any questions, confusion, if you can't find something in the archives, if you're looking for a specific broadcast, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. The caller at 0748, did you have commentary or were you just listening? 0748.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Gus. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I just had two quick points. I really was interested in learning more about Michael Sam's experience. Like, I think one of the callers touched on that because I heard about it happening a couple of months ago, but I never really went into it, like on an article or whatnot. So I didn't really know what happened with that. Like, I don't know if he went to some kind of public place or, like, what did he actually experience to make him come out and say that? Like, did you read up on that, Gus? Or
the article, I remember seeing it, but it was a while ago. It was this spring. Let's see. I'm looking at it now. Let's see. We'll all be informed. Let's see. All right, Michael Sam. I experienced more racism in gay community than homophobia in black community. Michael Sam is going to be part of covering attitude. Let's see. Michael Sam is going to be covering attitudes may issue in the interview for his cover piece. He is opening up about being part of both the gay community and the black community, as well as the challenges that come from being in both. Sam is aware of the longstanding whispers about homophobia in the black community, but actually he said he has seen nothing but support from the black community while there were some in the gay community who had problems with the color of his skin. Michael Sam, Attitude Magazine. There are a lot of black people, openly gay people, Sam said. Queerity reported, a lot of people have gay friends, cousins, brothers, sisters. They have at least one openly gay person. At least it's more accepting. That's my experience. People tell me they have family members who are gay and it doesn't freak them out, and no black person ever freaked out at me. Oh, you're gay? None. On the other hand, he said the racism in the gay community was terrible. People have told me I'm not gay enough. People have told me I'm not black enough, Sam told Attitude. I don't know what that means. You want to be accepted by other people, but you don't even accept someone just because of the color of their skin. I just don't understand that at all. How are you saying that? Oh, I want people to accept me because I'm gay, but I don't accept you because you're black or because you're white or because you're Asian. And it goes on from there. I'm reading this from griot.com, but they have a link to the whole issue where you can check it out from Attitudes, where he talks about this in detail. From what I read, they had direct quotes right from the portions that they quoted. So from what I read, it seems like there's still a little bit of confusion about racism, white supremacy. But it seems like he does give some specific anecdotes about things that I would suspect these would be white gay people did to reject him or let him know that he was not all the way down because he is not white, black.
See, it just goes to show you that white supremacy always dominates. And when it comes to the gay topic or the sexual issue or whatever, like I still think about that white woman, that white couple who had to move out of that neighborhood because they ended up conceiving a non-white child. Like, I think that should be, like, that shouldn't be lost when we're having these conversations when, you know, gay people want to say, you know, this is equal to racism. When you had this couple, you know, they had to move out of the neighborhood, you know, like they were saying, or one of the ladies was saying, like, hey, I can't get caught, you know, having this child in the house. And then, you know, she even going as far to put forth a lawsuit against the donor clinic, I think. So, yeah, you know, I constantly think about that one story, and I'm thinking, like, the contradictions when they say, like, white supremacists will say, you know, I'm colorblind, and then you look at them with this flag, it's got all these colors on it, you know, like the rainbow flag. Like, I never had that explained. Like, I wonder where did that come from? Like, what does that have to do with the what they call a sexual orientation? So that might be, you know, more symbolism confusion, I guess. And there was a story I read today with this pastor in South Africa, I believe, and I think his name was Andre Oliver. Like, I don't know if you had heard about this, but he was in I guess one of his church sermons and saying that something about, you know, accept white people into your life, you know, and we worked hard for what we got, and we didn't steal anything, you know, we're not the problem. And apparently it's been a very big issue over there. And there was this black female talking to him on the phone, on the speaker, and she was saying, you know, hey, you know, we're supposed to go by South African law, like, not, she was saying God's law, I guess that's what he was going by. And he wouldn't allow black people to come stay in this, I guess, suites or something like that. And he was saying, you know, we gotta segregate because, you know, God says so. So I was thinking, you know, religion or white supremacy, you know, like, that's the dominant one. Even though he might say that he a Christian or something, you know, that's what I thought about when I had read that story. And that's all I had.
I didn't see that about the pastor. I have to check on that. We have enough folks listening in South Africa at this point that I have to see if any of them heard about that, or if they, I do listen to Cape Talk 702, Reedy Klabi. She's a black female radio host in South Africa. I do listen to her program regularly, and they do frequently talk about white supremacy, racism. I have to see if they do a segment on that, if it, you know, caused a big brouhaha over there. But I'll definitely keep my eyes and ears alert for more information on that. And just, I can only say with the gay thing, that is massive tool of confusion, and just the level of deception. That's the thing that stood out to me more than anything else in this book, that there seemed to be, at least in terms of people who were doing the investigating, enforcement officials and attorneys, there seemed to be quite a few people that were there who were saying, I don't think that this was a hate crime. I don't think there's any evidence that this was a hate crime. I don't think Matthew Shepard was killed because he was gay, but that just was not widely reported at all. Like, it was, no, we have mobilized. This is a hate crime, and, you know, forget that James Byrd fella. It is Matthew Shepard. We'll maybe include him as a second thought, but this is about white Matthew Shepard, him being killed because he was gay. And I guess I'll end there. If you think a black person, whatever the circumstance, they were the victim, they were killed, whatever. If you think that white people are going to let it go, that this black person sexually molested multiple children, not just one, but sexually molested children, and they're just going to conveniently leave that to the side or make a deliberate effort to seal those records so that people do not have access to that information when they make a conclusion about what they think about incidents and what they think about this person and what happened to them, man. Psh. Anywho, as I said, just check the Black Talk Radio page if just to get the time. We should be here, like I said, on Tuesday. We'll get the commentary from Dr. Cambon, his thoughts, remembrance on Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. I'm sure we'll have a few other tidbits to get to as well, but that should be Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Again, drop an email if you get confused. UntilJustice@gmail.com. I am certain folks will be out gallivanting and acting a fool over the next 24, probably 48 hours. I would again encourage we are still in a system of white supremacy. It is never a good time to lax in your codification. I would certainly encourage lots of sobriety over the next 48 hours or so. You do not want to have there be any excuses for whites to come terrorize you or come to you. We had that audio clip this weekend about the party in Massachusetts that a black people were having, and the police came and broke up the party, and then the firefighter gloated saying that he hoped the house burned down. He wasn't going to help him put it out. I would just try to do everything possible, low-key, sober, so that you do not give racists any excuse to come and say, oh, we have to make problems for you because you've been a nuisance or you've been loud or what have you. I think Scotty Reed had shared within the last, I think it was within the last 2 or 3 years, that over the 4th of July weekend, at least once, that somebody might have came to his property in the midst of all of the hoopla and fireworks and what have you to, you know, do something incorrect. I had to go back to get the dates correct, but I know he, in an effort of black self-respect, defended his residence. I have always thought that this is a great time if you are a criminal to go out and commit crimes, because there's so much noise and commotion and people are being drunk and debauchery that people are not really paying attention. So I would keep that in mind as well if you're a black person, because, hey, the purge is out and all of that is going to be focused on harm black people anyway. So definitely make sure that you are vigilant, paying attention. It's going to be a lot of drunken, rowdy folks out the next 2 days, I would suspect, at least. Keep that in mind if you're out and about on the road. Certainly, you do not want to be under the influence if you're going to be behind the wheel. Man, you know there are going to be a lot of checkpoints, sobriety checks, at least until Wednesday, I would suspect. Probably disproportionately set up in black neighborhoods. Keep that in mind. If you got to consume any alcohol or other intoxicants, get to one spot and stay there. That way you can wake up refreshed and sober the next day, and then you can go about your business and not have to worry about being stopped, terrorized, maybe even killed, raped by Daniel Holtzclaw, Daniel Pantaleo, Darren Wilson, race soldiers, and it might even just be a white citizen. They don't even have to have a badge to cause you a whole lot of problems and or take your life. Sobriety would be best, and certainly buckle up if you're going to be behind the wheel. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Thanks all for tuning in. If you were late or didn't tune in because the description was late being posted, the archive should be up within the next 60 minutes or so. Just stay tuned. You'll be able to download and listen to it in its entirety. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported 7+ years. Hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That said, we will catch you all, I believe, Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in, creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing off. Stay safe.
stay codified.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.